In, we have Senate File 1471, Senator Ekins, Senator Fischbach moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carries. Senator Ekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1471 deals with nursing home receiverships. The Minnesota Department of Health has existing statutory authority to obtain receivership authority over nursing homes when the life and safety of residents is threatened because of the actions or inactions of the facility operators or owners. These actions are extremely rare. In the past 10 years, there have been only four receiverships affecting five nursing homes. So again, very rare. It's only when the Department of Health determines that it's necessary to undertake a state receivership because it has concluded that the conditions on site are life-threatening and time is of essence. And this bill deals with the time factor, for one thing. Receiverships are court-ordered, but before the Department of Health can go to court, it must have an agreement with a managing agent who will do the actual day-to-day operations. And the process can take about a week. There's always the risk that the Department of Health will not even find a managing agent. The whole process from the internal decision to proceed with the receivership to obtain the court order takes about 2 weeks. So some of the things that are done here include establishing a list of requiring that the Department of Health establishes and maintains a list of qualified managing agent candidates to choose from so that that can expedite the situation. Also, it shortens the time frame for the judge to issue an order authorizing a receivership from 5 days to 2 days. It also clarifies that a receiver can use all the payments received to pay for the costs of caring for and housing the residents safely. And that is the first primary objective here, is making sure that the residents are safe. So those are some of the portions of this bill. Again, expediting the situation because time is of essence to make sure that the residents are safe and being taken care of. I do have an amendment as well that was brought forward. The Hospital Association would be the 8-4 amendment, and I don't know if somebody's been identified.
I'll offer that.
To move that.
Sure.
Okay, Senator Dibble moves adoption of the 8-4. Could we have that distributed, please?
Mr. Chair.
Let's call out the fiscal notes. Can we ask about the fiscal notes?
Oh, I think so. We're in finance.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal note to this? I haven't seen it.
Mr.
Nauman.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson, there is no fiscal note with this bill. So,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, if there's no fiscal note, why do we have the bill?
Mr. Nauman,
I don't have the answer to that, Mr. Chair. Give me a moment.
The answer to Senator Fischbach's question is Mr. Nauman is going to come up with an answer, and it's going to be a good one in a couple minutes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm certainly looking forward to it. I really am.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
I don't think it would be the first time that we had a bill in here that didn't have a fiscal note.
Well, this is the first time I've seen the bill. Obviously, since we don't have fiscal notes where we have monies within the bill, or revenues within the bill that don't necessarily have an expenditure, but it redirects money. But Senator Westrom?
It probably sounds simple enough. We can move on it while we're finding the answer.
Well, listen, we have the A4 amendment distributed. Senator Dibbles moved the amendment. Senator Ekin on the amendment.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This amendment addresses what could be viewed as an oversight from the bill that passed dealing with medical marijuana. The bill that passed was silent on whether a hospital can allow the use of medical cannabis in the facility. We do address this in the bill that did pass for nursing homes and residential care facilities, but it was not addressed for hospitals. It really should have been. Hospitals, because it remains silent on hospitals would need to refuse to allow the product to be used in the facility and would need to confiscate the product as contraband under federal law. And hospitals, they need the same immunity and authority as residential care facilities in order to allow them to use medical cannabis in their facilities. And so that's what this is designed to address. The omissions of hospitals from the statute would impede hospitals' ability to allow the product even in their facilities, and would also inhibit their ability to manage the use of this drug in the hospital facilities. So that's what this amendment deals with. The Minnesota Hospital Association strongly supports this, and so we're bringing it forward for them.
No. All right, we have Senator Dibble's motion. Are there questions for Senator Ekin on the amendment? Okay, if not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
It's changing.
Mr. Chair, I do have Susan Winkleman, Assistant Division Director from the Department of Health, here to answer questions, too, if any questions.
No questions for Mr. Norman. I was checking. I'm kind of glancing at this. It looks like there's a redirection of monies or adjustments to the
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nunn. Mr. Nunn.
So, Mr. Chair, it's not uncommon in bills that end up in the Finance Committee where there is a assumed fiscal cost, or maybe the bill had a cost when it was originally referred into the Finance Committee. And on some occasions, this one included, the provision has been amended out. So it's my understanding from the Department of Health that there was a Medicaid reimbursement issue associated with this bill that was subsequently amended out in division. So now the bill no longer carries a cost.
And the only members of the division we have on the full committee are Senator Fischbach, Senator Laurie. So I don't see Senator Fischbach. I don't know if you recall the bill in division with the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Or Senator Laurie, if you recall.
Vaguely.
Does that make sense as to what Mr. Nauman just said?
I'm sorry. I was just sitting down and getting up to speed, and I'm a little
Well, the question was that as to where the fiscal note is, Mr. Nauman checked with the agency, with the folks from health, and apparently there was an amendment, or there was language in your division that was amended out of the bill, but it was at that point already in the Finance Committee. Sound familiar?
You know, I'm struggling with this one, to tell you the truth. Receivership? I mean, I know that folks from... Oh, here's somebody from MDH.
Well, committee members like to... Senator Westrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, nobody's got questions. I think we're in a move-it mood tonight, so... I have one of those four nursing homes that is in my district... So I'm somewhat familiar. What Senator Ekins talked about all makes sense to me, and why they would need to move as quick as they can. And so, short of that, I'd be supportive of voting it out of here.
Senator Newman.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, given the fact that there is no fiscal implication, maybe we ought to just move it out of the committee without recommendation and let it move on its way. I mean, because... I'm not even sure why it's here, with the fiscal implications having been amended out.
Well, it's here because it's within the Finance Committee, was in the division, so there's no other place for it to go other than the full committee to get it to the floor. So that's why it's here. You can't leave the division and go to the floor without coming through the full committee. So it's simple as that.
Senator Mr. Peterson? Chair, I would move that the bill be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only question I had would be, it sounded like the answer with no fiscal impact, then Health and Human Services is willing to deal with this issue within their regular budget. Is that an accurate statement?
That's what it sounds like, Senator Peterson, but so I would defer to
health.
Yeah.
To the health. Yeah, it was Senator Laurie?
Mr. Chair, it would be the Department of Health, and I think there was a fiscal issue that was addressed in this amendment, but it was handled rather quickly. And with this amendment, the Department of Health said that with the amendment, there was no longer a fiscal note associated. So there was one when it was sent to finance, and it needed to be there. But then in working with it,
do that.
It was able to be accommodated with an amendment to remove the cost.
So, Senator Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair, you know, one of the first actions this committee took this year was to deal with the deficiency bill. Was the Department of Health, did they have a deficiency bill, or was that somebody, that was somebody else? Were they part of that deficiency bill?
I'm sorry, good question, but there were deficiencies in the Department of Health in the deficiency bill. That was
So that's my question for you, or Mr. Chair, or the author, or the Department of Health. One of the first bills I thought we dealt with this session, this Finance Committee dealt with, was a deficiency bill.
Yep.
And I'm concerned that this is going to contribute to future deficiencies if it's part of their normal budget.
Okay. The deficiency bill obviously dealt with, if you recall, members recall, dealt with the Ebola crisis. Is there someone from the agency who would like to?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lurie?
They're not absorbing costs. We removed the costs with an amendment. With the amendment put on, there are no costs to absorb. So it's not like they're absorbing costs.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Fischbach.
So this amendment, the A4 that we just put on, eliminated?
No.
In division, so, that was done.
But, Mr. Chair, okay, this one?
Smoke marijuana.
Well, because I guess I'm not seeing the path of this. It was in Health and Human Services and Housing, and then it went to Judiciary, and then it was re-referred to Finance. So the amendment was put on in Health and Human Finance. Okay.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, the amendment was put on in our division, and we don't have then an engrossment coming out of a division coming to the full finance. So what we have is the engrossed version as it came to our division, and then the committee report, which presents the amendment that we adopted that took out the fiscal impacts as it was initially referred to us. And so,
and Mr. Chair, we have found the amendment. It was to delete including payments for services provided before receivership in the bill. And again, I have Susan Winkleman here from the department who can explain what that amendment did.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Do my motion.
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody would like to listen to testimony. And Senator Fischbach, you moved the division report, so I assumed you were okay with it.
Mr. Chair, yes, I guess I did. Yeah. I don't think we need testimony. I think that what we need to do is rethink the system that we are moving these bills through the committee system, because when we have...
Well, keep in mind, members, just so everybody understands, the bill was in a division of the Finance Committee, so it couldn't go from the division to the floor. It had to come through the full committee. So whatever shape it was in or put in division,
Judiciary.
There's not a choice. We don't have to get into necessarily a long debate about it, but just so people understand, Senator Lurie?
Yeah, and also I would add, sometimes as a division chair, I flag something that may or may not have a fiscal impact that I actually need to call into the division to see if it does. And sometimes the author hopes that it doesn't, and as they learn some of the things that they get when they see a fiscal note, they'll address it and fix it and remove a fiscal impact so that it can travel on its own. This is pretty standard around the place. And so this one came, you know, it was flagged. It was found to have a fiscal. We adopted an amendment that took the fiscal out so that it could travel on its own. But the only path that it can take is through the full finance division once it's in this division. We're not a standing committee. We are just a division of this finance. And so it's not a unique. I had one this morning. I mean, our autopsy bill was sent because we thought it might have a cost. It had a report in it we took out and didn't have costs. And we came through this morning with several bills that were in divisions to take a look and found to not have a cost, and we're moving them to the floor.
At the risk of offering a lecture to all of you who have more recently come from the other body, that's the way we handle it here. Senator Miller.
I'd like to move Senate File 1470.
Senator Newman already has that motion.
Let's move it.
Mr.
Question.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, my bill coming up in a couple of bills here has the exact same thing. No fiscal note, all the same thing. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm not say we already have this bill, conversation? But I would like to vote on this bill. Well,
but, Mr. Chair, how many of the bills, Mr. Chair, how many of these bills are in that are that way tonight?
Well, we have a few of them, so that's what happens in division. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I'm going to add to the problem or help.
Don't add.
I don't think there's a problem.
I will not attempt to add to it, except to echo, I think, points that have all been already made, simply that sometimes bills are brought into the Finance Committee because there is a perception or maybe a known cost. And the division will either accept that cost through the fiscal note process. Fiscal notes being mostly advisory, they provide a reason for a discussion between the author and the agency to determine how do we address the cost. Is it paid for? Is it assumed to be eaten by the agency? That discussion processes a bill either with a cost to the full Finance Committee and, in this occasion, without a full cost. As has been already noted, the process then involves a meeting here to move the bill directly to the floor.
So we have Sarah Newman's motion in front of us. As long as all members who've been here less than 4 years are now comfortable, those who've been here more than 4 years, you should understand all of this. Sarah Newman's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, next we have I think Senator Jensen's bill sent file 26.
Mr. Chair, just as a note, it's not that, Mr. Chair, that anyone over 4 year who's been here over 4 years doesn't understand. It just seems that there is possibly a better way to handle these things. And if we have a potentially different setup, because we end up with a lot of policy here.
Sarah Fischbach, after the committee meeting, let's you and I discuss procedures of the State Senate, and we can revise those if needed. Sarah Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I was just commenting that it's pretty hard to change Senate rules, so we wouldn't probably want to do that.
All right. Yep. Then we're all comfortable. Yep. Let me, before Senator Jensen goes ahead.
Sarah, would you ask Senator Westrom if he'd like some water?
I am kind of thirsty.
waiting for the sergeant to open up the floor.
Okay. All right. Let's try to pay attention. I know we're going to have. I was remiss, however, before we go to Senator Jensen, we do have a new member of the committee, Senator Johnson. Nice to have you here. I bet you're impressed so far.
I am. And,
you know, Mr. Chair, she was here this afternoon, and she came back for more. So,
all right. All right. So, Senator Jensen, on Senate File 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 26, it establishes a mechanism for self-storage facilities to offer consumers to obtain a limited insurance coverage for loss of their or damage of personal property in a self-storage unit. The reason that I'm here today is because originally when it was heard in Commerce, we had a fiscal note prepared. We made changes in that committee that removed the section of the bill that said that the self-storage would have to file for and pay a fee. So I did not get, and there was not, a new revised fiscal note, but the Department of Commerce is here today. If you have questions about that, they have, because of the change that happened in Commerce, that there is no fiscal impact any longer in this bill. Mr. Chair.
All right.
Peter Brickwoody is here from the Department of Commerce. If
okay.
people have questions
if any,
on that.
Anybody has any questions for Mr. Brickwoody? Otherwise,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Commerce is not a division. Finance. Or is it? Maybe I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair.
Well, within.
But, well, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious because it was actually on, it looks like it was on the floor and then sent here even after the amendment in Commerce.
Well, Senator Jensen has indicated what had happened. It was felt that there was a fiscal issue, came here, and then in working with the agency, with the Department of Commerce, it was determined that there was not a fiscal issue, but it was already in the Finance Committee.
All right, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard her say it a little different, that they had amended it in Commerce, but that's fine. Well, I'm being told by my seatmate here to pick my fights another night, so maybe you'll get off easy tonight.
Do you want some water?
No.
No. No,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Saxon.
I move the bill.
Senator Saxon moves that Senate File 26 be recommended to pass. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we vote on that, I just had one quick question. In quickly browsing the fiscal note, it looks like there was some revenue to the state and some cost. The cost was nominal because they had to redo the licensing system, and then the $200 fee or whatever that was why the general fund was coming out ahead. Did you completely eliminate all of the licensing? Is that what you did?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nino, that section was removed from the bill.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. So then would the owner of ABC Storage, who's offering insurance to the individual renters, would they be doing that completely unregulated, or do they somehow still fall under Commerce?
Mr. Chair and
Senator Jensen.
They would still have to comply with the Section 72 that would apply to the regulation of insurance.
All right. Further questions for Senator Jensen? Otherwise, we have Senator Saxog's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Jensen, Senate File 383. Senator Lori moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 383 made some modifications to the optometrist board changes. Within this bill, there were some fee updates that hadn't taken place for 27 years. That's why it went to finance. It went to several committees, but it ended up in health division, and they removed the fees in that division and left with the policy. So Senate File 383 does not have a fiscal note any longer because the fee portion is in the omnibus health bill. And so this is just the policy related to that.
But
Mr. Chair.
Okay, and so there was in the division that you deleted Section 7.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
It's just moving through.
All right. Senator Lori.
And Mr. Chair, we did keep the fees, and we're tracking the fees on our spreadsheet, but the House had a policy bill without the fees, and we're lining up with them and trying not to carry policy in the omnibus budget bill at their direction.
So, members, if everybody heard Senator Lori, this reflects what we've done with other bills, where we have the money carried in the omnibus bill, in this case Senator Lori's omnibus bill, but then we still have the bill itself still within the Finance Committee. Make perfect sense, everybody, Senator Fischbach?
No. Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lori.
I do have an amendment to the bill that's come a little late. It's the A3 amendment. I'd like to offer the A3.
Mr. Chair, is this a policy amendment?
I don't know.
Maybe I should ask Senator Lori, Mr. Chair.
It's being passed out right now. It doesn't have any fiscal cost. It would be policy. I would like members to consider it. What this does is it strikes for the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, it strikes a requirement that no more than two shall be graduates from the same college of chiropractic. We currently have three openings to the Board of Chiropractic, two chiropractor openings, and we have one of the current board members already attended Northwestern College. The problem is we only have one college that teaches chiropractic in Minnesota. That is Northwestern. And so really right now we have a bias against chiropractors that were trained in Minnesota. And as the governor tries to appoint these two new members, he can't appoint the two. Only graduates of Northwestern have applied to be appointed. And if we leave this prohibition to having more than two from any one college in statute, he won't be able to fill these appointments. And it really doesn't make sense, given that we only have the one. They produce about 170 chiropractors a year, many of whom go on to practice in Minnesota, and they are the majority of our practicing chiropractors. And so this limitation just really doesn't make any sense, and again, discriminates against chiropractors who choose to get their training in Minnesota. It doesn't really make much sense for Minnesota. So it is a policy amendment, but I ask members to consider it. I think Senator Jensen is aware of this and is glad to carry this. It's a rather late-breaking issue because these are open and the applications are in, and it's unworkable with this bar. So I'd move the A3 amendment.
Okay, we have Senator Lori's motion. Is there discussion? Senator Jensen, I think you've nodded your
That's correct,
assent.
Mr. Chair. I'm aware of the amendment. And
on Senator Lori's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, so, if we're going to have a new policy of doing, I mean, I'm just, so, Mr. Chair, I just want to understand.
Senator Fischbach, obviously any amendment is an order. If we had some huge new policy, I would probably try to discourage that if it was some omnibus policy bill out of nowhere, but without going through the policy committee in this case, if we have minor language, we've done that all the time, as you're well aware. But did you have supper tonight, Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, as a matter of fact, no, I did not. So if you'd like to run and get me some, I'd be happy to.
All right. So we have we've had Senator Jensen's explanation. Is there further discussion on the bill? Senator Lori moves adoption of Senate File 383 as amended. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator Jensen. We have Senator Dibble. Senate File 1771. So Senator Lori moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Same discussion as we had a couple of bills ago. This does not have a fiscal note. The reason for that is that at one time, and maybe Senator Lori can help me remember, at one time it was thought that actually this bill would save money. It turns out to be revenue neutral or fiscally neutral, but it was sent from policy up to division. Now it's here. It needs to bounce up to the floor. What this does, Mr. Chair and members, is it makes some technical amendments to the medical cannabis bill that we passed last year, just as things have been rolling out. Some of the implementation pieces are being changed a little bit because they make more sense. A couple of things that hadn't been thought about were added. I'm going to also offer the same amendment that Senator Eakin offered to his bill in just a moment, but I'll walk through the bill very quickly so everyone can understand it. Added in division was an amendment that defines as medical cannabis the plant form of cannabis while it's being processed for the purpose of being turned into the substances that are approved for use as medical cannabis. This allows those who are engaged in the employment of processing the plant form to avoid breaking the law and being in possession of something that's illegal. And then the re-registration of existing manufacturers, rather than occurring every year, would occur every 2 years. We had initially proposed every 3 years, but it was amended down to 2 years. It just seems to make more sense to do that. Every year is a little bit too frequent for what's required. Moving to section 2, which is on page 2. These are just a couple of housekeeping items around enrolling patients to ensure that the fees are first received before a patient is enrolled, making sure that there's a timeline for the commissioner to approve placing a patient, enrolling a patient in the program, setting a 30-day standard, except that in the initial startup phase, it allows for a 60-day standard for the commissioner to make sure that a patient is enrolled. It also ensures that the enrollment ceases should a patient pass away. Moving on to section 3, which starts on 3, but the actual language change is on page 4, 4.3. This is just kind of changing a little bit of a timing element. The manufacturers have to contract with laboratories for the purpose of ensuring content and purity and some of those quality control measures, and this just ensures that those laboratories are approved prior to the manufacturer contracting with them rather than after the fact. In section 4, there's an annual audit that's required of the manufacturers. It doesn't make sense to do that audit this year. There wouldn't be much to audit because things are getting up off the ground. So it starts for the calendar year beginning this year. And, of course, then the audit would be due after there's some data to actually, some activity to actually audit. And then finally, Section 20, members may recall that the commissioner is empowered to add additional conditions that patients may suffer for the purpose of qualifying for medical cannabis. There's a limited number of conditions in law right now. The Commissioner of Health can consider adding those, but the Commissioner has to undertake a certain process and also has to indicate that he or she intends to place a particular condition on the list of qualifying conditions and then await the legislative session, the next legislative session, before it actually becomes effective. And in the law, the first condition that the commissioner has to consider is intractable pain. The agency, the commissioner, is undertaking the analysis and the examination, and that work is going to be completed prior to the date, the deadline that we gave to the commissioner, and that will be January of this coming year. So if, in fact, he completes his work, or he will complete his work by January, that'll allow the opportunity for the next session to occur, giving the legislature the opportunity to act in some form or manner that it sees fit. And then if intractable pain were to go on the list, then it could occur immediately following the next legislative session. So that is the extent of the bill. I can pause for questions or offer the A5 amendment.
We have some questions. Senator Engelbrechtson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions, Senator Dibble. So without this legislation, substance cannot be produced, correct? I mean, this is something that was forgotten about or an oversight in the original bill, the plant matter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrechtson, that's a fair question. It hasn't been asked. I don't quite know the answer. I do know that employees who are engaged in the manufacturer will be handling the plants, and the plants themselves are not defined for the purpose of being inside the facility and processing into oils or other substances as medical cannabis, so they'd be an illegal. So I guess the real question is, would law enforcement go into the facility and charge those employees with a crime or not? I don't think they would, but they could, and we wouldn't want them to do that.
Just a follow-up question. Thank you, Senator. And also the intractable pain, can you describe your best description of what that is just for myself and the committee members?
Well,
I know it's in statute, Senator, but I just wanted to get a little
better. I don't have the statute memorized. We can crack the book if you want, but it's a fairly specific definition of certain kinds of pain attached to certain kinds of illnesses. So you know, it's very very specifically and legally defined as being, you know, a very very serious matter. So it's not like my elbow hurts. So there we go. I'll read it. So as defined in law, means a pain state in which the cause of the pain cannot be removed or otherwise treated with the consent of the patient, and in which, in the generally accepted course of medical practice, no relief or cure of the cause of the pain is possible or none has been found after reasonable efforts. Reasonable efforts for relieving or curing the cause of the pain may be determined on the basis of, but are not limited to, the following. When treating a non-terminally ill patient for intractable pain, evaluation by the attending physician and one or more physicians specializing in pain medicine or the treatment of the area, system, or organ of the body perceived as the source of the pain. Or, two, when treating a terminally ill patient, evaluation by the attending physician who does so in accordance with the level of care, skill, and treatment that would be recognized by a reasonably prudent physician under similar conditions and circumstances.
Thank you.
That's intractable.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, can you offer some insight in regards to the registry program? How are they notified when one of the patients dies? How are they removed from the registry program?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, patients are under the ongoing care of a physician, and regular reports are made, about the patient's condition. I can't remember the frequency. You know, Mr. Munson-Ragala can help me out here a little bit. There's a regular reporting mechanism required as a requirement of being a part of the program about how a patient is doing. And, you know, if a patient has died, that would be a report that would need to be made.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, if the testifier has a specific answer, I mean, it's I think we're all aware of that. Okay. There's a significant amount of fraud around the death of family members that are receiving various types of benefits, not only on the state level but on the federal level. And it would be important for me to understand how somebody is removed, how their name is removed from this registry when they die.
So, Mr. Chair, I would ask Mr. Munson-Ragala to respond specifically.
Could you just identify yourself? And
Mr. Chair, Manny Munson-Ragala, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Health. Senator Peterson, I think the answer to your question is the patients provide a monthly report when they come to the facility about the sort of the course of their response to the medication. So one of the ways we would be informed that the patient has passed away is if someone tried to show up the next month trying to pretend to be the patient. So that would be one check. No person can get into the facility without proof of identity. So that would be the kind of our first check. The second opportunity to sort of verify that the patient is still qualifying is that the registration is an annual registration. They need to go back and be recertified by their physician. If there is no recertification, they would be removed from our registry. And then lastly, we're in conversation with our colleagues in the other part of the department that handles vital records to see if we can do some cross-checking with respect to death certificates against our registry. That's a more of a longer-term prospect, but those are the kind of conversations we're engaged in.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Senator Dibble right now? Senator Dibble, then you've got we've had distributed, I think, the A5 amendment. So Senator Dibble moves adoption of the A5 amendment. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, this is the same amendment that was offered to Senator Eakin's bill, allowing hospitals to provide for ability to treat patients who are in the program.
Okay. Further discussion on Senator Dibble's amendment? Senator Peterson, did you? Okay. Senator Dibble moves adoption of the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Is there further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1771 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. We have Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, did I hear? Okay, we have Senator Dietzick, Senate File 698. Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report.
Is there a division report?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Dietzick.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 698. Senate File 698 is a legislative citizen commission on Minnesota resources recommendations for projects to be funded from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund beginning July 1, 2015. Joining me this past year on LCCMR were Senator Tomasoni, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dames, and Senator Westrum. The LCCMR funding priorities for 2015 include foundational natural resource data and information, environment education, water resources, aquatic and terrestrial invasive species, air quality, climate change, and renewable energy, methods to protect, restore, and enhance land, water, and habitat, and land acquisition for habitat recreation. The LCCMR received 152 proposals from its request for proposal process, totaling approximately $126 million. The process is a competitive, multi-step process. The commission looks at why the project should be done, what the problem and or challenge it is addressing, what are the goals and outcomes of the project, and how the project will achieve those goals. We also ask what other resources, including in-kind and non-state funding sources, will be applied to the project. After hearing 76 presentations, we are recommending that 65 proposals receive funding. The 65 proposals are asking for approximately $46 million in funding from the trust fund. You have several handouts in your packet. The handouts include our biennial report, a sheet that has some information about the process, summary information, a breakdown of recipient and recipient categories. Then there is a list of recommendations with proposed funding. That's this sheet. And then we have another sheet with additional information. And then the last sheet in your package should be a summary and proposed and map of the proposed acquisitions. We are recommending 19 proposals related to foundation natural resource data and information totaling almost $13 million. Several of these projects are continuing efforts, and others are building off previous studies. They provide critical information for land use planning efforts and policy planning decisions. These projects include the production of county geological atlases, the Minnesota Biological Survey, the Minnesota Native Bee Atlas, updating the National Wetland Inventory for Minnesota, and digitizing the Minnesota Biodiversity Atlas and the historic Gillian Ruffled Grouse Research. Other proposals in this category will look at the effects of grazing versus fire for prairie management, the correlation between the declining turtle population in metro area lakes and water quality, the movement and seasonal habitat of Minnesota elk, and the impact of white-nosed syndrome on the forest habitat of endangered bats. We are recommending 9 proposals relating to water resources totaling about $3 million. Some of these projects are assessing water-related risks to industry, municipality, and ecosystems and quantifying the economic value of water, assessing the presence of emerging contaminants in Minnesota lakes, developing tools to remove pollutants and contaminants from the lakes, and improving ability to accurately quantify sediment loads. We are recommending 5 proposals for about $1 million for environment education, including providing hands-on learning experiences to students so they can learn about and understand watersheds, water resources, and water quality through school programs, 4-H clubs, and summer camps. There's also a proposal to increase awareness on alternatives to lead ammunition for hunting to protect wildlife from accidental lead poisoning. This project has a wide range of supporters from the DNR to Isaac Walton League to the Deer Hunters Association. We are recommending 4 proposals for about $6 million relating to aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species. $5 million of that funding is for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. The goal of the center is to develop new tools and techniques to eliminate, reduce, mitigate, and prevent the introduction, expansion, and damage done by terrestrial invasive species. The center, which is located at the University of Minnesota, will work with partners and prioritize to support multiple projects. Partners will include the DNR, Ag Department, Minnesota Forest Council, and the USD Forest Resources, along with local units of government. Terrestrial invasives damage our forest and urban landscapes. Pests and pathogens destroy fruit and grain harvests. The economic impact in Minnesota is about $3 billion annually. The remaining $1 million in this category is to fund to continue research to develop strategies to increase the resilience of the $1 billion ash trees in the ecosystem potentially impacted by the emerald ash borer, a biological control for Canada thistle, and research to stop a new emerging threat that has been found in the Winona area, the heterobidacean. This is an invasive root rot. It looks like a mushroom, actually, that attacks red and white pines and is considered the most destructive disease in conifers in the U.S. We are recommending four proposals for about $3.3 million related to air quality, climate change, and renewable energy, including an ambitious project involving U of M Twin Cities and Morris campuses to develop and demonstrate alternative, renewable, and sustainable new technologies for producing nitrogen fertilizers that are realistic for companies and farmers. A proposal to collect comprehensive data and analysis of energy systems to develop future energy strategies that will give decision makers information they need on clean energy production that maximizes Minnesota jobs, economic development, and the health of Minnesota citizens. And a proposal to develop a model for building deconstruction to reduce landfill waste and provide job training. We are recommending 11 proposals for about $4.6 million to protect, restore, and enhance land, water, and habitat, including the final phase of the Minnesota Conservation Assistance Program to provide assistance in enrollment and retention of private lands and conservation programs, a proposal to identify key areas in the North Shore streams that are essential to sustaining trout fisheries, a coordinated multi-county effort to restore rare native plant species, a proposal to provide grants and technical assistance to local communities to strengthen and maintain urban forests, and a program to collect, preserve, and enable conservation of at least 15 species of Minnesota native orchids. We are recommending 11 proposals for about $14 million for land acquisition for habitat and recreation. About $9 million of this is for the DNR for scientific natural area acquisition and restoration, native prairie stewardship and prairie bank easement acquisition, Metro Conservation Corridors Wildlife Management Acquisition, and State Parks and Trails Land Acquisition. Other projects in this category include the Mesabi Trail on the Range, Metro Parks Land Acquisition, a collaboration with Crow Wing and Cass County to protect lakes in North Central area by securing permanent easements of high-quality habitat areas, and developing a conservation easement assessment and valuation system. The proposals need to give specifics and identify the property to be purchased, and all land purchase with LCCMR money is from willing sellers, not through eminent domain. In addition to the 65 proposals we are recommending, we are requesting time extensions for a few proposals originally funded in 2011, 2013, and 2014. These projects are not requesting or receiving additional funds, just additional time for completion, mostly because our funding starts in July, which is midsummer, mid-planting and field season in Minnesota. We are also updating language relating to peer review process used to evaluate proposals. Members, these proposals have been reviewed and discussed by the LCCMR Commission members. We looked at how they are proposing to spend the funding, the possible outcomes, and how the outcomes could benefit Minnesota. We have an opportunity to fund some interesting proposals with lots of potential to provide research and data to improve and protect our environment and our quality of life in Minnesota. I'd like to thank Ms. Susan Thornton, Executive Director for the LCCMR, Mike Banker, Michael McDonald, and Diana Griffiths, the LCMR staff, for their great work reviewing and preparing all the materials for our meetings and this hearing. And with me today is Susan Thornton, the Executive Director, to help answer any questions. And with that, I'll stand for questions, and thank you for your time and considerations.
Well spoken, Senator Dietzick. That's as quick a presentation as we could have hoped for.
Otherwise, we could go through each one, 65 at about a minute apiece. Here for an hour.
And members should take note that Senator Dietzick's seatmate is Senator Tomasoni, so it's an interesting contrast. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. It is rather interesting, actually. He's now mine.
To somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I've been going through this, and I'm looking at the acquisitions, both in the metro area as well as outstate Minnesota. 350 acres here on page 25 of the bill, acquisition, restoration, enhance. And generally speaking, and I think it's 675 acres below in perpetual easements. And most generally, these acquisitions are done through legacy funding. Unless they have specific science and nature research and outcome. Am I inaccurate? Maybe Ms. Thornton could answer that. But some of this seems like legacy funding stuff, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingerton, the LCCMR, since I've been on it, which is 3 years now, they've actually done, they actually have provided funding along with, some of them are similar projects to the Legacy and Outdoor Heritage, and others are, they are scientific in area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could follow up, does this seem like an awful lot, though, in comparison to years? Looking at the bills over the last years, do you see the acquisition here fairly large? You're talking SNAs and...
It's actually less than last year.
Okay. We skipped that one. Is there some scientific in nature research that's going on in some of these, or are these just acquisitions of buffered areas, or maybe a little better explanation, if you would. Madam, and I do understand the corridor concept. I understand that's been around for some time, so I understand running things together and the benefits and the value of that.
So, Senator Dietzick, Ms. Thornton?
Mr. Chair, Susan Thornton, Director with LCCMR, and Senator Ingerbritsen, to answer specifically, I believe you're talking about scientific and natural area acquisition. There's also restoration, enhancement, and public engagement included in this. So it is about $2 million of the $4 million is for acquisition of the SNA programs, and we also have a prioritization list and try and look at what's in Legacy also. So they have, for a number of years, as a number of other organizations have used, sought funding from both funds.
Senator Britson.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Members, another word that's becoming a little troublesome to me that I, and it's just for information, and I'll throw it out, the word perpetual. And I know there's been discussion amongst a lot of legislators with regards to that's a long time, and we're not sure that we might be, we're always concerned about strapping the legislature down with decisions in years to come, but we're talking about forever here, and it's just information I want to throw out there that maybe 40 years from now, the landscape has changed where we actually want to be able to do something with these lands. So it's just a little food for thought if I could throw that out. And I guess the reason I ask this question is that I'm forever hearing the acquisition of properties through the Lasard Sams committee that I've been on since its inception. My point I'm trying to make is that they're not the only one that is in the business of acquisition. And it just seemed like there was an awful lot in here, but I stand corrected if you had less this year than last year. It wasn't much of a question. It was more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Dietzick, I have a question about a small appropriation on page 13 on the promotion of alternative ammunition to protect wildlife from lead poisoning. So I understand what it says, but so how do you get from A to B to C? Who does the instructing, and how do they get to the sportsmen to let them know?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think part of this is an educational. It is an educational opportunity. I'm looking for my little.
So I understand that. I'm just wondering how sportsmen hunters will get access to this information.
To provide outreach, and Mr. Chair, it is to provide hunters with outreach and workshops on alternatives to lead hunting, increased awareness among hunters about unintended consequences,
I read that.
Yep.
What I'm wondering is, so how do the hunters learn this? Does the Raptor Center send a letter out to all the hunters, licensees in the state? What's the...
I think it is workshops, Mr. Chair, and then also I know several of the sporting goods stores have been having discussions and looking into this.
Okay.
So,
Ms. Thornton?
Mr. Chair, members, and also, if I may add, working with DNR, with the outreach that they are doing and their various firearm safety training and so forth. And so it's really a consortium of outreach efforts by these various organizations for this.
All right, thanks. Senator Ingerbritsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one further question, if I could, of Ms. Thornton, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thornton, would you give me a little bit of a breakdown, or at least an average maybe, or a percentage of Seven County Metro versus Greater Minnesota, in all fairness to my question last night at the committee? Do you have that at all?
Ms. Thornton? Mr. Chair, members, Senator Ingebrigtsen, are you seeking that information for acquisitions or overall of what's in the bill?
I'm sorry, acquisitions, sure. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm doing it very quickly. I did not add it myself off of this legal sheet that was in your packet of handouts. And as you will see, state parks, of course, that's statewide, but none of the, at least on the priority list right now, are in the metro areas, $1 million. The state scientific and natural areas are both metro and non-metro, again, based on willing sellers. So I don't know the breakdown there. The state wildlife management area is in Dakota County on the Vermilion River. Metro Parks, $1 million. And Minnesota Wildlife Valley Refuge is the greater 13 county metro area. So, Mr. Chair, I think you'll see somewhat of a balance there in answer to your question. I do my math quickly.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dietzick, in light of what we've been hearing, I see at least one study, and there may be more relating to migratory birds. Did you guys hear any proposals, or is there any consideration in terms of spending some dollars in terms of evaluating those migratory birds relating to the type A viruses or the avian flu that is certainly we're seeing now in turkeys and poultry, but also is can be found in wild aquatic birds. In fact, I think at this point many people believe that that's what's kind of taking this across the country is the migratory birds. Have you done any work on that? Is there any discussions of any of this funding being utilized to help with that that problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, these proposals came in last summer, and we heard them last summer, and so this was before the recent outbreak. But our hopes is that is some of what this terrestrial invasive species can do, is that and they will be able to do rapid response to something just like this, where they can help try to figure out what is causing this problem.
Senators, I'm sorry.
So,
Senator Peterson, I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, it's because we didn't have time to get the proposals in? Is that the answer?
No, Mr. Chair, I think the proposals were put in last summer, and so this was not an emerging issue at the time, and so no one thought to put in a proposal.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dietzick or Ms. Thornton, I've had several lake associations confront me with the concern of aquatic invasive species and the fact that they put in, they purchase materials to take care of the aquatic invasive species. And I see on page 15 that it shows that you've allocated so much money to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota for this to do a study. And I'm wondering if in all of these different areas where you have designated money for these different studies, if there is a report that's required on them. And I don't see a report required in each one of these where it says the appropriation is available, by which time the project must be completed and final products delivered. But it doesn't say there's a report coming back to the legislature about this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, they do work plans, and then they continually update those work plans and do quarterly reports. The money here from the, you know, we did U, and then we've also given money to the Aquatic Invasive Species Center at the U to do some research on everything from zebra mussels to quagga mussels to the invasive carp. We also gave a lot of money, and I think there was a proposal last year in probably Lasard Sam's potentially in here that dealt with some of the lake associations. So we have looked at that from multiple different levels from the local government and the DNR. We have one of the extensions here that is a proposal on the time extension that we're doing is for a proposal for the DNR. Mostly that is focusing on the invasive carp, but there are other projects that we have done that have gone from the algae all the way to the zebra mussels and the quagga mussels.
Mr. Chair, what I'm asking about is the fact of a report coming back.
The
legislature will get a report on this?
The LCCMR gets a report.
And then we'll get a report from them
the
to the
LCCMR.
And how soon will we get that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, there are, it depends on the, well, we get reports every biennially. Well, on the progress and problems to date, and then the finals, these projects, these appropriations usually take 2 to 3 years to complete, some longer. So the final is later, and we try and have various presentations on those, and they're also always posted on our website.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. The promotion of alternative ammunition to protect wildlife from lead poisoning. Can you explain that to me and how that came up? It's $132,000 per year. I'm sorry, recommendation $132,000 total.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingerson, can you explain your question again?
I'm sorry, it's the promotion.
Yep.
Of alternative ammunition, not the research about whether lead is dangerous or not to human consumption, but the promotion. How are those dollars going to be expended?
I think those are, Mr. Chair and Senator, those are so they're for promotional and outreach to the different organizations from the DNR on some of their fire safety training to the hunters associations, deer hunters associations, and so it's mostly outreach, I believe, to the different groups of giving them. Giving, you know, letting people know what the options are and what alternatives are.
It's to the University of Minnesota.
It's Mr. Chair. Yes, it's to the Rapture Center. Yeah, so they're coordinating it, and they're working with the whole collaboration of all these different stakeholders.
Thank you.
Further questions for Senator Disick, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure exactly to whom to ask this question, so I'm just going to ask it and whoever can best answer. In a similar vein is what Senator Ingerbretson started out asking about the land acquisition. My question is, do we, in that, it's a significant amount of here, I think it's about 30%, 14 million or so. In that, do we calculate the potential fiscal implications for locals, for the state? Typically, I would imagine we're buying private land. We're not buying from the county or the city, although that might happen, I guess. So we're taking it off the local tax rolls. What are the interactions with PILT? What about statewide property taxes and the implications of that? Is that accounted for in all of this land acquisition that we do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, members. I do have a sheet with estimated PILT payments. Looking in my trove papers for, I believe it's in the $15,000 to $25,000 range for the acquisitions that are here. A number of these are easements, so they stay on the purchase of easements, so they stay on the property rolls. And then, so we do a look at the calculation potentially of PILT payments. In the case of state parks, you're often adding to the inholdings, so you're actually creating a land-based efficiency, both for the agency and the local unit of government that's there. Metro regional parks, those are units of the local unit of government. And then my understanding is that there is a federal PILT payment made for the wildlife refuge.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll follow up. And what about those lands where we whether they might be perpetual leases or whether it's an outright purchase, but they're not attached to a park. But the DNR would be managing that to enhance land, water, and habitat. Or do we calculate that those costs that as we get more land, presumably it's going to cost more to do that in more locations. Is that something that we account for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, we in looking at the evaluation, yes, we do look at that. But really what we're trying to do here is add to that corridor or that habitat. So these aren't just isolated parcels being purchased. The goal is that we're providing a more of a connectivity and so that you would have more efficient management of those lands. So those are questions that are asked. You're absolutely right.
Mr. Chair, another follow-up. Well, I'll give you a personal example of where it was an isolated instance and legacy funds were used, and it caused a problem for a constituent, and we had to really push back with the department to get some things fixed. So I know that does happen. We're, typically, you're looking at SNAs or something, that, which was the case for my constituent. So I don't serve on these committees, so I don't have any background to be able to tell you that this is a significant activity or just a minuscule activity, but I know that it does happen, and it's not just attached to existing state lands. And I was just curious if we somehow, as we add more and more and more of this land into state ownership, either de facto ownership via lease or outright ownership, are we accounting for those costs that we will be pushing out and accruing into the future? And it's somewhat related to some of the comments of Senator Ingebrigtsen, but I just was curious how carefully we're actually paying attention to that. I was wanting to hear the answers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, so on the Environment Committee and actually in Tax Committee, Environment Finance, we have actually have a lot of those conversations on, you know, how much, and this is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and how do you pay for that? And so that is a question that we do actually have, and then it, what is, when is that tipping point of when too much is too much? But from the standpoint of what we do here in the LCCMR committee, we get these proposals, and one of the things that we ask that, you know, the DNR when they're submitting the proposals or when the Metro Parks or who's ever submitting the proposals, they're supposed to be strategic investments. And so we do want them to be strategic, and we don't want, you know, if it's a random spot out here, it needs to be from the, you know, a scientifically important area or an important wildlife management area, and otherwise we do want it to be, you know, connecting that corridor. And so those are questions that, you know, we do ask and that, you know, we're asking the DNR and our partners to also ask. Yeah, and so the SNA on page 25, under the SNA acquisition, restoration, enhancement, and public engagement, you know, the land acquired with this appropriation must be sufficiently improved to meet at least minimum management standards, and so as determined by the DNR commissioner. And so, you know, we do work with them, and they can kind of say, no, this is not in our priority right now. So they make, as the DNR does their process, they you know, kind of determine strategically, does this work for us right now or not, and how significant is this? So we kind of also use their management skills and their scientific skills.
Further questions for Senator Dietzick? Senator Tomasoni. Okay, Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 698 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Dietz and Ms. Horton.
Thank you, members, for your time.
Senator Sieben. Senator Sieben, Senate File 455. Yeah. And Senator Sieben, we have in the packet attached to the bill the 831 amendment, I believe, which is an author's amendment. Why don't you present the bill?
Really?
Mr. Chair, I couldn't really hear you, but I think you said there is an amendment in the packet?
Yes.
Okay. So, and Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the omnibus elections bill. And so I'm going to try to be very brief in my overview of the entire bill. but I will focus on the portions of the bill that have the fiscal impact. And then, of course, if there are other questions, we're welcome, or I'm happy to try to answer your questions. So the Article 1 is a variety of election administration changes that that encompass a whole big section of the bill. One of them that does have a fiscal cost, as you can see in the fiscal note, is we are recommending in here an emergency planning task force. And this proposal has moved through a variety of policy committees, the idea being that if there is a natural disaster, for example, or a mass power outage on Election Day, Minnesota statutes are not entirely complete in what steps should be taken for our election system. And so we're proposing a task force with a variety of stakeholders to come up with recommended changes. Article 2 of the bill is the Senator Eakin's provision for a Uniform Presidential Electors Act. Article 3 relates to voter registration. There's a provision from Senator Carlson that would allow 16 and 17-year-olds the opportunity to pre-register to vote. And then it also authors a bill that I authored that would allow individuals to automatically register when they sign up or renew their driver's license or state ID unless they choose not to. Article 4 is Senator Champion's bill on the restoration of the right to vote for people who have felony convictions. Article 5 relates to early voting. This is a bill that I authored. It provides a 12-day window beginning 15 days before the election and ending on the third day before for individuals to vote early. Article 6 is a redistricting provision carried by Senator Hayden that changes the way individuals who are incarcerated are counted during the census. And then Article 7 is the appropriation. So the bill that's before us costs $99,000. $22,000 is for that emergency planning task force that I mentioned, and $77,000 is for the Office of the Secretary of State for printing costs and programming changes for design of the early voting legislation that's proposed in the bill before us. So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take questions or to then I do have two amendments.
Okay, let me make clear to members so there's no confusion. Senator Steven indicated that the cost of this bill is $99,000. This is a bill being presented to the full committee. It's not been in a division. Mr. Nauman, maybe you might just comment on the $99,000.
Mr. Chairman, based on the fiscal note that's attached to the bill, and I believe a subsequent amendment will incorporate the appropriate appropriations. This bill carries a cost of $22,000 for the LCC and the legislative branch and $78,000 in fiscal year 16 and a savings of $1,000 in fiscal 17. So netting all those numbers out, it's a $99,000 fiscal effect in fiscal 16-17 biennium and $53,000 of fiscal effect in the tails to the Secretary of State for the ongoing costs associated with the provision just described earlier.
And members, we were aware of this bill some time ago and have been tracking the cost actually for several weeks, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, since the fiscal note was originally completed, actually, in the original version of this, we had a lower number, but the most recent, the fiscal note was completed on the 22nd. We've been carrying $99,000 since that point.
Okay. Questions for Senator Steben on the bill? And Senator Steben, I know you've got the amendment, but questions on the bill itself? Okay, otherwise, Senator Steben?
Mr. Chair, I have two amendments. The first that I'll offer for members' consideration is the A31 amendment. This is a bill that Senator Eakin offered or carried on behalf of the League of Cities. It changes the filing fees for people who are filing for office. It's the A31 amendment that I think it's in your packets.
Okay, so the A31 amendment was attached to the bill.
Okay.
Is there discussion on the A31 amendment? If not, Senator Stephen moves adoption of the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the second amendment that I'd like the committee to consider, to be clear, it did have an informational hearing in the subcommittee on elections, but it is the A32 amendment that is the June primary. And Mr. Chair, to be clear, this was heard as an informational bill in the subcommittee, but it has not been attached to the bill as it's moved through the various other committees that this bill, the omnibus bill, has made it a stop. But I'd like the committee to consider attaching the June primary, recognizing that we don't have an updated fiscal note then for the cost of implementing a June primary. But I just think that we have a good bill before us, and the June primary makes the bill a little bit better, and wanted to see what members thought about having it on there.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, do you feel this is significant policy, or is this, I guess I'm trying to watch and figure out where the rules are. So is this significant policy, or is this policy we can deal with in the Finance Committee?
Well, Senator Fischbach, obviously in any committee we don't have germaneness rules as we do on the floor. So the committee can consider it. Obviously, if folks think it's, you know, I can't rule an amendment out of order. A committee chair doesn't have that authority. Obviously, this does is a policy consideration, not inappropriate for the omnibus policy, for this omnibus policy bill, but it's up, obviously, to members of the committee.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I was just trying to get my arms around the explanation you gave earlier regarding, you know, little policy we kind of do, but you did indicate that, you know, significant policy, and this has only had an informational hearing, I guess is what Senator Stephen called it, in one other committee. So I was just curious if that would be considered, but it's, I guess it's not. So thank you.
You're welcome. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stephen, we had a discussion in the subcommittee of the Elections Committee. Didn't have a vote, and now we have no recommendation from the Policy Committee. So why would you think that the Finance Committee could give a recommendation when the members that are on the Election Committee haven't even given a recommendation?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, we did have a rather robust discussion about different options for moving the primary to different times throughout the year. And it just seems to me that this is a discussion that I want to continue to have. Obviously, if the committee doesn't choose to add it onto the bill, that's certainly one option. But I would point out for members that the June primary amendment that's before us would take effect in 2018. Just to explain it a little bit, it would move the candidate filing period to March, would begin roughly March 27th, just to give members some idea. The state primary then would be on June 19th, beginning in 2018. This does have strong support from the party chairs of both parties who have supported moving the primary to June. And, you know, it is a pretty significant policy difference, but I think it's worth this committee considering. And then, obviously, if the election bill moves forward for a floor vote. I'm sure there'll be further discussion for all members of the Senate on the floor.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, I'm conflicted on this because on the one hand, I support the notion of having a June primary. On the other hand, I think I heard Senator Sieben say that she doesn't know what the fiscal impact will be, and we are in the Finance Committee, and it is a significant policy change in the state of Minnesota. So on the one hand, I would like to support this notion, but on the other hand, because we're in a Finance Committee, I would really like to know what the cost is. I will say, Senator Sieben, while I would really like to see this move forward, I would also like to see what it's going to cost, and therefore I don't think I'm going to be able to support your amendment at this time.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I was, not addressing that because that's a different point, but I was just going to say that, it's no secret that I've always supported June primary, so putting that aside, it just seems as though Senator Sieben is almost in some ways offering an amendment to her bill so that she can have the bill in the shape that she'd like it in when it gets to the floor. And so perhaps, given some members' concerns, it could be to pass the bill out without recommendation to the floor so that it could be just as a suggestion.
Senator Sieben.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the June primary has enough support, or I shouldn't say enough support, but enough interest among some members of the Senate where it would likely be offered on the floor. So if there's concern about it being offered here, it will certainly be germane, I would think, to the overall elections omnibus bill on the floor. With that being said, it's sort of up to the will of the committee. I think that it might be best to add it here and talk about it further, but we could also, I don't mind waiting and discussing it on the floor.
Senator Sieben, I know that you and I talked very briefly about this earlier today, and to be honest, I was kind of jumping around for most of the day. Mr. Nauman and I have been talking, and we're not quite sure what the expense might be, and so you and I really didn't have a chance to talk about that part of it. Mr. Nauman, do you have any thoughts on the expense of the change of date?
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I can tell you that this language, as you have in front of you in the form of the A32 amendment, has not been fiscal noted in either body. So we don't know the exact cost. When fiscal staff was made aware that this might be offered today, we had a conversation about what potential costs might exist. And we certainly are of the opinion that if there were a cost, and I'm not saying there is one way or the other, it would probably be one-time programming type costs associated with the Secretary of State's office, if there were. But it would be probably in the tails or late in the biennium. But we can't speak specifically to it because this was never a bill that we assumed was needing a fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, if we could hear from Ms. Struther from the Office of the Secretary of State.
Okay. Ms. Struther.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Struther with the Office of the Secretary of State. This bill did go through the committee process in the House and passed out to the floor. Again, I understand there wasn't a fiscal note requested, but we did do an internal analysis of if there would be a cost. We end up having to do programming annually to the system that we do for candidate filing, which would be the small programming that you mentioned. But otherwise, there would be no cost to our office. It's essentially just doing the work at a different time.
So is the position of the Secretary's office that any cost would be assumed within the budget of the office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would be within the budget of the office or absorbed by the budget of the office, but also there would be essentially no new work created by it. It would just be doing work at a different time. So there would be no real net cost for our office.
Okay. So the position is that even absent a fiscal note, you're saying on the record that there'll be no cost. If there is a cost, expect it to be minimal and absorbed within the office.
Correct.
And has that been run by MMB? Is that your understanding of what?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and this is why we never got a fiscal note request in the other body regarding this. So this has not been run by MMB, but we did run it by our election staff that would be doing the work if we moved to a June primary, and they reported that it would essentially be just shifting their calendar around to be doing the work at a different time.
All right. There was Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Struthers, any analysis as to the cost at the local level or any level at the state agency or at the state level other than Secretary of State?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe there was testimony in committee about the calendar on the local level and there being significant adjustments that would need to be made to their staffing to move this to June. But that was, I think, part of the reason for a delayed effective date, because it would give them time to adjust their calendar to 2018. But I can't speak for the cities and counties that are the ones that administer the election. To the second part of your question, I'm unaware of any other state agency costs other than our office.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
And Ms. Struthers, to the significant adjustments at the local level, you didn't mention any potential costs. Was there any discussion in terms of the cost at the local level?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, to add to what Ms. Struthers said, my notes here is that MACO is neutral on the primary date change with a 2018 effective date, but they were concerned that several counties are in the process of purchasing new election equipment, and therefore, a 2016 effective date could be problematic for some of their counties with the testing needs that need to take place before the election. But the 2018 effective date does help with that. But in some smaller counties, there was testimony about that the folks who administer the elections also have other job duties, including property tax administration, and that can coincide with the earlier primary date. So in some of the smaller counties, there is concern that a June primary will coincide with other work that individuals do.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, Ms. Struthers, I still haven't heard a number. Was there any number discussed in the elections committee as to the potential cost at the local level?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, no.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'm concerned about the fiscal cost. I think it's just a plain bad idea. We got woefully low turnout in September, so we moved it to August, and it got lower. And I've got a funny feeling it's going to get even worse in June. Not to mention, we may have to revamp our whole method of campaign finance, because we're in session all the way up to the middle of May, and potentially we're in session during the primary in June. And I just think this is the wrong timing. I don't think this is a good idea at all. I just don't think we should do it, and I don't think we should pass it.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, in looking at this fiscal note here, it talks about none of the sections. This is without this amendment, of course, but none of the sections that affect state elections functions have any cash costs, primarily because all the changes regarding the ballot, marking the ballot, and the like are applied to ballots that would have to be created anew in the next election cycle. So basically, they're saying this bill, the bill without the amendment for the June 12th change. There's no real significant costs. There might be some costs, but they do list some in this fiscal note that would let me believe that there probably would not be any cost if they did a fiscal note on it.
Senator Britson.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I have to kind of echo what Senator Newman talked about, and now the testimony is that there are some counties that may run into some costs here. And that was going to be my question to start with, was what is a local impact going to be? And here we are talking an awful lot about what could happen and what is going to happen. Mr. Chair, I guess I'm wondering if you're okay passing this out, this pretty major piece of legislation. And Senator Steben, I'm kind of undecided whether I like it or not, but the bottom line is, Mr. Chair, are you okay passing this off with this bill here without a reasonable
Chair?
Impact, or a fiscal impact statement?
Senator Steben.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to remind Senator Ingebrigtsen or reiterate what I said earlier, that MACO, which is the Association of Minnesota County Election Officials, they're neutral on the bill. They're not opposed with the 2018 effective date.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Steben, you said that, however, there were some counties that did have some major scheduling changes, and I think that's why Senator Newman kept asking what was going to cost. And I suppose they have no numbers with that because they don't know what kind of staffing measures they had. But did you not say there were some counties that were just undecided?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen. That's right. Some smaller counties that are members of MACO had concerns about the scheduling, the backup of the time. But overall, the association is neutral on the bill. I'd also just point out for the committee that, you know, we're talking about local impact notes. There are significant savings for counties contained in the broader elections bill that aren't necessarily reflected in the fiscal note. But because of the changes from a system of no excuse in-person absentee voting to an early voting system, there is really quite significant savings for some counties to administer their elections.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Chair, we're saying that we're going to be able to pay for this inside the bill as it first came before the amendment. Is that what you're saying? Is that there's some savings in here? Is that shown on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, that's not what I said. What I said is the amendment does have some local costs especially for smaller counties if we adopt the June primary. But the overall bill will have savings for counties in administering their elections if the bill is passed as it's before us.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just wanted to make a comment about the idea of moving to June. Clearly, August there's no good month, really. Clearly, August is a bad month when people are on vacations. And it just seems to me, if especially early in June when the kids are still in school, before families start their vacations, we might have a better chance at getting a better turnout. So I think, I don't know if August was a compromise between September and June, and it wasn't a very good compromise. I think June is a much better month.
Mr. Rother, I want to get back to your answer relative to the fiscal issue. I'm a little bit concerned by what sounds like some degree of ambiguity and hadn't anticipated that earlier today. And you indicated there's been no discussion with MMB about this. Is that correct? And I'm talking about a fiscal note, but you haven't talked to MMB about this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have not talked to MMB about this. It's possible that Bert Black, who does the fiscal notes in our office, may have discussed this with MMB. But because there was no fiscal note requested in the other body, we did not have a formal discussion with MMB. To your point about my ambiguity, part of this may be because I'm not the technical person in our office who does this, but my understanding is that there is work done programming-wise every election, and that same work would need to be done if we moved it to June. It would just involve doing the same work at a different time, so the cost to our office would be the same whether or not we're doing the work in June or in August.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. Again, I don't know, there's a little bit of a casualness that normally we don't hear from, you know, if an agency says we can absorb this within our
our budget, there's usually some check against that. Again, not necessarily a formal fiscal note. And again, I hadn't thought about that earlier as to the cost, but other questions from members? Cernino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of quick non-fiscal comments on the bill, and then I do have a question that's fiscally related. On page 13, as I was reviewing this, I just happened to notice on the very bottom line, and we don't need to get into this now, but this is maybe just for your reference, it says each square shall be the same size, but everywhere else we've stripped out the word square and put in a new terminology. That might be right or might be wrong. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, and certainly you know that language is needed as the counties and election officials transition to different types of voting equipment. This is language to reflect the type of equipment that's used.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to find my note, and I can't find it. And I think it had to do with absentee voting or mail-in voting or something. And there was a time that was referenced, and it was 12 capital M period. And I can't remember which page that was on. It struck me as a weird way to reference a time frame, and that's maybe something to take a look at. But my fiscal question was, in looking through the fiscal note, there is a reference, well, I guess there's not a reference, there's an X in the box that says, yes, there's a local impact. And going through the narrative in the fiscal notes, I found a couple references where it said, well, there might be a little bit of a savings for the state and locals because of whatever. And there was another reference that said there will be minimal cost to the locals. And then I found...
So, Cernino, is this on the amendment?
I'm sorry. Do we have an amendment before us?
Yes.
I apologize. I'm so busy down into the minutiae that I forgot we didn't vote.
No, I apologize, but...
Let's just vote.
Yeah. Senator Bonoff, did you...
Mr. Chair, I just said, let's just vote on the amendment.
All right. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of confused. I thought we had policy committees to consider policy. Apparently, we don't have that anymore. We have policy committees that talk about issues, they don't vote on issues, and then they come up on the finance committee. I don't know why we have policy committees anymore. Might as well just have the finance committee do all the policy work. Just think of the efficiency we'd have. We could have just one long meeting late in the evening some night toward the end of the session, and we don't have to do all that little stuff of analyzing policies by a policy committee. Just a suggestion from whoever the chair is, and we can vote on it in a completely different committee. We haven't talked about how the time frame would be affected. We have to back up everything in the process of considering a June primary. What about our precinct caucuses? What about the time when candidates announce their candidacy? There's a number of different party functions that I'm sure we have to consider, which we haven't had any policy discussion on today. So, and I, quite honestly, I'm trying to put myself, as I've over the years tried to consider the June primary, what a rural legislator would have to do if they had to campaign in real time on a Facebook opponent who follows every single vote and then makes a big splash in a Facebook campaign back home while the rural candidate is here in St. Paul. And I can only imagine that you'd have a lot of very nervous rural candidates chewing their fingernails down, waiting to get out and campaign, but they're stuck in St. Paul until perhaps mid to late May. And then they have a whopping 3 weeks to campaign and present themselves to the populace while for maybe 5 months someone else has been campaigning on their every vote on an omnibus bill which has good and bad in it, and now they have to explain themselves to their constituency in all of 3 or 4 weeks. Just some things to consider, but, oh, by the way, we're not a policy committee, so we wouldn't have to consider any of this discussion in a finance committee.
Further discussion on the A32 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, given that we are doing policy, are we going to take any testimony? I don't know if anybody even would be here to for or against it, because it wasn't, it's not something that was necessarily known that was going to be done. But I mean, if there was, I mean, if we're going to deal with policy and the ambiguity of the finance issue, I guess I'm wondering, was the intent to take some testimony if anyone is interested? I don't know. I have no idea.
I don't know if that's the request, Senator Fischbach, you want to make to folks, if somebody wants to offer testimony.
That's fine. I mean, I just think that if we're going to be dealing with policy, that we at least potentially should, you know, make the offer that if anyone was interested.
I don't see any takers.
All right. So. Well, that's good.
All right. Is there further discussion? We have Senator Stevens' motion on the 832 amendment. What? Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, question for the author. Senator Stevens, I did mention that idea about without recommendation, because there does some, I mean, forgetting where people stand on the policy one way or another. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are with regard to that, so that it doesn't put members in a position of.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, why don't we see that what the outcome of the amendment is first before we move to that next
Senator Limmer.
Motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, was there any public announcement that this amendment would be coming up today?
You know, we notice the bills on the agenda. We don't notice amendments.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I asked that question, you see, is in a policy committee, our rules would say that we have to give the public 3-day notice in order to be prepared to give testimony in a committee. We don't have any public testimony in this room right now. And this is a very significant policy change for the state of Minnesota. And I'm somewhat surprised that we would consider, and maybe that's why we try to limit policy to very minor issues when it's in the front of a finance committee, because we don't give the public the notice that they deserve. The public notice that's in the rules of the Senate when it comes to policy questions and bills to consider. And Senator Fischbach, you asked for testimony, but how would anyone know that this policy discussion would ever take place because there was no public notice? Of course there's no public testimony tonight.
Okay. Further discussion on the 832 amendment. Senator Sieben moves.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Anderson.
I'd like a roll call.
All right. Further discussion? If not,
Mr. Chair.
Senator, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, just a quick statement, because we're going to be going on the record. I honestly have no idea at this point whether a June primary is a good idea or a bad idea. I'm not going to support the amendment because it is. I know we've gotten a little loose with policy discussions in the Finance Committee and have become accustomed to that. Mr. Chair, that's fine. I'm not entirely opposed to that. But this isn't a small change, and it's not even because it is something that can be divisive. It has, as Senator Tomasoni and Senator Limmer referenced, potentially broad implications that we simply are not going to have the opportunity to talk through here. And those implications might be good, they might be bad, they might be mitigated by changing the proposed language. I just don't know. And so I'm in a position of, I think in the past I've even voted for it at times as it's come through. But I'm not quite sure where I stand, and for that reason, because it's coming up here and it really is significant, I'm just not comfortable voting to send it to the floor. And obviously the authors, if it doesn't pass here, can offer it on the floor if she likes, and you know, we'll vote again, and who knows what I'll do there. But I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I thought that this proposal had bipartisan support, so maybe I'm overplaying my hand here by offering the amendment at this time. We had a hearing, an informational hearing in the subcommittee. We heard other bills that were changing the date to different times. We had a we did take testimony from various groups in the subcommittee that I expressed here today some of their concerns and positions. But, you know, we can have the discussion on the floor where there's less opportunity for input as well. So, you know, I'm more interested in seeing the entire bill pass through the committee tonight. So, long way of saying it, but I'll withdraw the amendment at this time.
Senator Stevens withdrawn the A32 amendment. Is there further discussion on Senate File 455? Senator Nino.
Now to the time where my question is appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Sir.
And Senator Sieben, I had started to talk about the fiscal note that I'd seen a brief reference to. There might be some local savings. There might be just a minimal local cost. But the part that struck me as potentially having the most impact is the early voting as far as local impact. And my question was, I couldn't find anything in the fiscal notes here. There's just a very generic paragraph or two that talks about that and doesn't say whether there will be no cost or there will be cost. It just talks about how it will play out. Was there a local impact statement requested? Did we have that? Is it available? If not, why not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nino, this is an omnibus bill, so Senate File 141 is contained in the bill. And there was a local impact note done on Senate File 141, and that showed a savings to local units of government of about $234,000 in a non-presidential year and close to $550,000 a year in a presidential year, specifically for the early voting provision. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Senate File 414, not 141.
All right. Do we have further discussion on Senate File 455? If not, Senator Stephen moves that Senate File 455 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you,
Senator Stephen. So, Senator Pappas, would you? So, Senator Pappas, pension bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Ms. Thoreau with me if there are any technical questions. She is new with the Pension Commission, but has been doing a great job in the few months she's been with us. I'm just going to give you kind of a brief overview of the pension bill, and then I have some amendments. And I wanted to just announce at the onset that the money in the pension bill is being carried in the state government's bill. So there actually is no, there are no dollars that are being carried in the pension bill itself. Article 1, 2, and 3 has to do with the interest rate assumption changes. We are lowering the interest rate assumption from 8.5% to 8% for the Minnesota State Retirement System, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Plan. Article 2 and 3 is in coordination with that. The interest rate for repaying members' refunds will be lowered from the 8.5% rate to the 8% rate. In Article 4, these are the cost of living adjustments and modifications, and the minimum period a retiree must wait before being eligible is increased from 3 to 6 months for the St. Paul teacher retirees, and other technical amendments are being made to MSRS TRA and PERA. TRA is the Teachers Retirement Associations. And also future COLAs are to be reduced if the funded ratios decline, future plan COLAs. In Article 5, these are the employer and employee contribution stabilizers, and we're shifting that from a mandatory rate-setting procedure to advisory procedure, and we list various indicators that the governing board should consider in making stabilizer recommendations. Article 6 is the police and firefighters' retirement supplemental state aid, which is made permanent. Article 7 makes modifications to the statewide volunteer fire plan administered by PERA. Article 8 expands the statewide volunteer firefighter retirement plan administered by PERA to include monthly benefit for the volunteer firefighter relief associations in addition to lump sum plans. Article 9 are the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association Working Group recommendations, and these incorporate the recommendations of the State Auditor's Volunteer Fire Working Group, and she is here if members have any questions. Article 10 has to do with particular Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association changes. It allows the Roseville Volunteer Firefighter Association to increase the number of retired board members, retiree board members. It allows the Centennial Fire District volunteer firefighters to transfer their service credits. Article 11 are small group retirement changes, like extending MSRS unclassified defined contribution plans, extending it to part-time legislative employees, extending the PERA general retirement coverage to employees formerly employed by Regional Development Commission and are now employed by the Minnesota River Area's Agency on Aging, to exclude certain current Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board trade personnel from PERA in favor of union retirement coverage, and authorize various individual service credit purchases. Article 12 makes various technical amendments. Article 13 is a cleanup article to remove obsolete dates. Article 14 is the MRF merger, and it completely merges the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund into the PERA general plan and sets the contribution rates for what the employer pays and what the state pays, and those are lowered, so the local employer contribution rate is lowered from $27 million to $21 million at a savings of $6 million, and it sets the state contribution rate at $16 million from $24 million at a savings of $8 million. And as I mentioned, that's being carried in the state government bill. And it allows former MRF members to continue with the basic plan coverage rather than coordinating with Social Security. Mr. Chairman, if there aren't any questions at this time, I have some amendments.
Are there questions for Senator Pappas or Ms. Thurlow? Senator Pappas.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I have the A1 amendment. I think the members already
members,
have.
That should already be attached to the bill.
The 1A amendment. The 1A amendment is a technical amendment that clarifies the eligibility period to receive a post-retirement adjustment for MSRS, PERA, and TRA retirees by specifying that a member must be retired for a certain period of time as of the June 30th before the adjustment. I'll move the 1A amendment.
Go ahead. The members have questions on the 1A amendment. Not Senator Pappas moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Pappas.
Then I have the 2A amendment. And this makes corrections regarding the birth date and date of employment for individual purchasing pass for an individual purchasing pass service credit. And it also removes language to clarify that the authority to purchase the service credit only expires on June 30th, 2015. That's the 2A amendment.
We have questions on Senator Pappas' motion on the 2A amendment. Not all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed.
Then I have the 4A amendment.
Senator Pappas.
4A amendment clarifies that the state contributions end on September 15th, 2031. This is for MRF. By eliminating inaccurate language that allowed the contributions to end when PERA General, not the former MRF division, becomes fully funded. And that would potentially result in all members of PERA General subsidizing the MRF liabilities. That's the 4A.
Senator Pappas moves adoption of the 4A amendment. Is there a discussion on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed.
Mr. Chairman, then I have the A1 amendment, which I don't know if you have that one.
I don't believe so.
That one has
we
to be
we could have that distributed.
That.
Okay, if we can wait a minute until that's been distributed to everybody. Senator Pappas on the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is really a technical correction regarding the Minneapolis Municipal Retirement Association dues. It inadvertently caused their dues collecting ability to expire, and they would like to continue to do that. It wasn't our intention to remove their ability to continue collecting dues.
We have Senator Pappas' motion on the A1 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Pappas.
That's it, Mr. Chairman. And then we're ready to go to the floor then. So I'd like to move, if there are no questions, that whatever the bill number is, Senate File 1398 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. As amended.
Okay, we have Senator Pappas' motion. Is there further discussion on the motion?
I'd like to thank members for the discussion and all your intelligent questions about the pension.
I do have a question.
Oh, no, I spoke too soon. I'm sorry.
I know.
Shut up.
Mr. Chair, I do have a quick question.
Mr.
Chair, Mr. Nominor, Senator Pappas, could you just remind us how much was carried in Senator Saxhog's bill that does correspond to the pension bill?
It's a savings of, Mr. Nama, is it $14 million or $16 million? Savings of $16
million. Mr.
Nama. Mr. Chair and Senator Bonner, the annual change was $8 million of reduction to PERA from the general fund. So that's a $16 million annual reduction, or biennial reduction, rather. And that was in the state government budget division bill that we heard in this committee.
Yeah, thank you. So that had to do with how much, in order to complete the merger of MRF into PERA, so much money had to be put into PERA to make them whole from the employer, mostly the city of Minneapolis, but there were a few other employers, and the state, because the state was also the employer of record. And the PERA staff and actuarial people calculated that that there could be a reduction.
Right behind.
I hope they're right.
Okay. Is there a further discussion? Okay. On Senator Pappas' motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I said no.
You said yes. Senator Lance? Senator Lance?
I'm going to go now?
Yeah. So, Senator Lance, Senate File 86.
I will.
Thank you.
So, Senator Lance and Senator Champion is going to share.
Okay, Senator Latz, we are ready. Ready for Senate File number 86.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File number 86 is a data practices bill that classifies sets the terms for use of and retention of the data collected by automated license plate readers when used by law enforcement agencies. The basic framework of the bill is that it provides for the retention period when the data is collected of 90 days from the date of collection, It provides for some specification on the kind of data that can be collected and retained. Basically, license plate numbers, date, time, and location, data on vehicles, pictures of the license plates. And it classifies that data as private data on individuals or non-public data. It allows for the data to be retained beyond the 90 days when requested by the subject of the data, when it's anticipated that may be used as exculpatory evidence in a criminal proceeding. There's some special provisions in there relating to the Safe at Home program that's administered by the Secretary of State's office. It provides for, requires logs of the use of the license plate readers. It provides for an audit that will be made public to be conducted every 3 years. It limits access to the data to only those authorized law enforcement personnel, subject to written procedures in each law enforcement agency. The authorization must be made in writing by the chief of police, sheriff, or head of the law enforcement agency or their designee.
I think so.
Can only be done with when there's reasonable suspicion that the data are pertinent to a criminal investigation, and the request for access must include a record of the factual basis for the request, an associated case number, complaint, or incident that's the basis for the request. So very narrow authorization for access to this data. It provides for a notice to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension of the location of fixed or stationary license plate readers and lists of the agencies that are using these readers. And the BCA, this is public information, the BCA is to post it on their website so that's accessible to the public. And then it provides for the post board, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, to put together a statewide model policy for the administration of the license plate readers throughout the state, and standards and procedures for compliance with this statute, and that policy process must include input from members of the public. Then further requires that local law enforcement agencies must adopt the local policies that are identical or substantially similar to the model policy adopted by the Post Board before that they can use the license plate readers, and provides deadlines for them to do so. The only fiscal aspect of this bill, when it was introduced, was a $5,000 fiscal note from the Post Board, because at the time they were frankly the subject of about five model policies in a variety of different bills that were introduced, and the overall accumulation of that of those requirements would have caused them to incur some expenses. But they have informed me, and the executive director is here to testify to this, that given the process of the session and the anticipated workload that they are now facing, since most of those, I think all of those other model policies are no longer parts of their respective bills, they've informed me that they can absorb the costs of this model policy within their agency budget without requiring an appropriation. And so they can testify, but at this point, I think that the fiscal note of $5,000 that was given to this bill is no longer an accurate fiscal note, and it ought to be, it should be zero for purposes of this committee's consideration. So with that said, I'm prepared to offer Mr. Gove here for testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, here's what we do. I think we have a couple questions. I'm going to start with Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that was heard, I believe, on two different days in the Judiciary Committee. We spent a significant amount of time on the policy issues of it. We then saw it, I believe, in the Transportation Committee, where we again spent a significant amount of time on the policy considerations. Senator Latz is now telling us that there is literally no fiscal implications on this matter. And given those facts, I would really urge members not to dive into the policy on this, because if you do, we're going to be here until midnight. And given the fact that we have already given a lot of consideration to the policy aspects, I will defer to Senator Latz, because he is a member of this committee, but I would urge that this matter be moved at this time to the Senate floor.
Members, I am inclined to agree. I hope that we would just focus on the fiscal aspect of things, because earlier I heard a lot of reaction around policy, and we should conduct ourselves accordingly. So with that being said, are there any other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a piece that was passed out here, but nobody's got their name on it. I'm just wondering who authorized that piece to be handed out.
I'm not sure, but members.
Rich Neumeister.
Members, let's remember, someone gives you something or something
has
something around that has to have one of our names on it. So it looks like it's from Rich Neumeister.
This one. The Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
Okay, so, all right. So we will, at this particular time, it looks like that's from Mr. Neumeister. Any other questions, Senator Anderson? I'm not sure what you're asking me, Senator Anderson.
There's a piece that's been handed out. It says Minnesota Coalition of Government Information Automated License Plate Reader Data. And there's no name on it.
No, that hasn't.
It looks like it's from the Minnesota Coalition of Government Information.
MNCOGI.
And there's someone here who could speak to it, but we really want to limit any discussion. We're only limited discussion just on the fiscal ideas here.
Well, but Mr. Chair, that's a change. I mean, earlier we were doing fiscal, or we were doing policy, and now on this bill we can't have policy.
Well, let me just, Senator Fischbach, I think you raised a very interesting question, but there's a new guy that's sitting in the chair. And so, from my vantage point, we will deal with the
Mr.
fiscal.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could explain it to my seatmate.
There's a new sheriff.
Senator Fischbach, the strong urging is to exercise a great restraint right now, but nobody's handcuffing your mouth if people want to ask questions.
And I will also thank you, Senator Rustum. I'll also echo the words of Senator Newman, who did talk about the fact that we wanted to make sure that he encouraged us not to dive into the policy aspects of things. That was the table set, and I was willing to eat from that particular table because I thought the meal would be good. So... Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Little dessert, if I might, here. Just one question. Senator Latz, would this change dramatically if it were a different number? It started at 180. Would it change dramatically at all fiscally if it were 120? That's the only question I have.
Fiscally?
Fiscally.
Senator Latz.
Financially. Money for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Engelbertson, right now, this bill has a zero fiscal note based on the information I've been given, and I don't think any changes in the retention period will affect that fiscal note at all.
That's my only question.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, given the discussion, and I really do urge the members to not dive into the policy, because we're going to wind up mired here. At this point, I would move that this bill be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor.
On that motion, any questions? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
Senate file 86 passes. And now we're going to Senator Cohen. Committee members, it is my understanding that we are going to be dealing with a Senate file.
data collection.
Yeah, I don't
heard all that. We don't need to hear
my hat's off.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, members, I've been given some additional information. Before Senator Cohen moves adoption of the division report, I just want you to know that there's a new spreadsheet that's coming out to you right now. So please disregard the spreadsheet that is currently in your packet. So a new spreadsheet is coming. So Senator Cohen?
Isn't that what you call it?
Mr. Chairman,
no.
If I can get it quiet, please, I'm sorry.
Everyone should be disgusted by the change in policy.
Was hoping we'll get the staff up here. But, Mr. Chairman and members, relative to the spreadsheet that's being passed out, there's actually only one change from what's in your packet, and that's to reflect the governor's recommendation. So there's no change in terms of action I'd like to ask committee members to make from the spreadsheet that you had.
So, Senator Cohen, you want to move adoption of the division report?
Yeah, would make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and all those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The division report is adopted. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it looks like folks are looking for the do members have the old spreadsheet? Does everybody here have the old spreadsheet? Mm-hmm. Okay, let me just indicate. The only change in the spreadsheet that was just distributed is to reflect the governor's recommendation on the Board of Arts. That was not contained. Otherwise, there's no difference. So, yep, see, everybody disappears. So what we have in the packet is what I'd like to present. Mr. Chairman, House File 303 is obviously the proposed legacy bill this year. Is Mr. Knopf and Mr. Mum here?
Oh, we're sitting behind you.
Oh, you were? Okay. All right. Let me offer some comments, Mr. Chairman and members, relative to the bill, and then I'm going to indicate some proposed changes from the subcommittee's action from last night. And I know I've had the opportunity to talk to Senator Fischbach, I think a couple of other members briefly about some of the proposed changes. And let me go through this article by article. But I want to make a couple of comments at the outset. So folks on the committee and folks here for the presentation of the bill understand a couple of things. First of all, members, please keep in mind that the legacy amendment is not ongoing money. There's not a base amount as such. This is a one-time expenditure. That's the nature of the legacy amendment. So there's nothing carried in the base as we see in the omnibus finance bills. And I think there's some misunderstanding relative to that. At least I've heard that from a couple of folks today. Second, something to keep in mind that's quite important from where this bill might have been a month ago. If we make changes as a legislature to the sales tax, that affects the monies we have available in this bill. Because of actions taken on the Senate floor a couple of days ago, there's approximately $1 million, and I had asked staff to put together the exact amounts. I don't have that, but approximately $1 million deducted from the forecasted amount for the legacy bill. And that's spread throughout the articles. So, for instance, Articles 1 and 2 are a third. Article 3 is, I think, 14.75. I believe Article 4 is 19.25 of the legacy amount. So you could do the approximate arithmetic. If members want the exact dollar amount, I'm going to have to turn that over to staff. Also want to indicate that I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion of what's happened in the other body, but keep in mind when you see if people talk to you about where the House might be, the House legacy bill passed before their tax bill did. So I don't believe, and again, staff can comment, I don't believe when you compare one to the other that the House legacy bill reflects the changes they made. Those changes, because, again, they had a much larger tax bill, those changes might reflect, I believe, as much as a $4 to $5 million difference from the forecasted amount. I mean, Mr. Brown, is that kind of just an approximate?
That's correct, yes.
So Senator Cohen, are we going to walk through the spreadsheet, or what would you like for us to do?
What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is just having made some of those preliminary comments, let me reflect on what's in the articles. First of all, Article 1, which is the Outdoor Heritage Fund. What we've done in the Senate, and this was done under Senator Ingebrigtsen's chairmanship as well as mine, is we have promised and told the sportsmen that we would present to the Senate the recommendations made out of the council. And I know we have about half the members who are on the subcommittee, so I'm going to make some comments that you will have heard yesterday. But when the legacy bill passed the Senate, both in 2006, I believe, and in 2007, members might recall who were members back then, that the bill in 2006 ultimately did not come out of the conference committee. The bill in 2007 actually passed and was not taken up on the last night of the 2007 session in the House, so we had to repass the bill the first month or so of the 2008 session. The sportsmen, who were the first folks involved with this, and there was the original amendment for the Outdoor Heritage proposal, which had been introduced, I think, as early as 1999, possibly 2000. The request had been to set up a council not dissimilar to the LCCMR, other kinds, the State Arts Board, and the request they had made was that we try to abide by the council recommendations, the work done by the council and the staff. And so that's what's presented in this bill. Senator Ingebrigtsen and Sarah Saxog are the Senate members of the council. They can speak in more detail than I can as to deliberations made within the council relative to the recommendations we have in front of us. But the only change made from the council recommendations as proposed in House File 303 is a very small language change relative to Clearwater County. And there was some extensive conversation in the subcommittee hearings when we heard the proposal from the council as presented by Mr. Johnson, the new executive director of the council, as well as Mr. Anderson, the present chair. Relative to the White Earth proposal, there was a Clearwater County commissioner who was present who testified as to some of the concerns they had. Those concerns relative to So the proposal, I believe, are answered both by the small language change, allowing access to the land in question, as well as a payment in the tax bill that we passed a couple of days ago, as authored by Senator Scoy. And Senator Scoy is also the senator from Clearwater County as well. Article 2 is the clean water section of the bill. And this is a section that ends up being somewhat of an amalgamation of both the agency and the Clean Water Council. Senator Scalzi is is the Senate member of the Clean Water Council, as well as
Senator Osmak.
I'm sorry, Senator Osmak. Another member of the council, and I'm trying to look around the table. I don't know if anybody is present who served with Senator Miriam other than myself, but former Senator Miriam, Senator Limmer, and Senator Pappas and Senator Fischbach, I believe, and Senator Stumpf. Okay, we've got a whole bunch of us who served with former Senator Miriam. I don't know if any other takers on that, but he's also a member of the Clean Water Council. So what I've attempted to do is to present certainly the priority agency requests. That includes, for instance, an authorization to the Water Quality Certification Program, where the agency was asking for money that would access approximately $9 million in federal support. There are some provisions presented by the Clean Water Council that are contained with this. There's some other parts of the bill. Maybe I should just highlight those in the clean water section of the bill that were not necessarily in either. There's a request for an appropriation for $1 million for each year for the Forever Green Institute for Crop Research. This was originally an appropriation contained in the Supplemental Finance Bill last year, which was authored by myself, which I was impressed with, and there's a request from, I would suggest, the environmental community to continue this. It's a program that has been working. If members want some testimony, we have folks here who can offer that. There's also, kind of glancing at my list, there's a request authored by Senator Stumpf for the sewer projects relative to water quality in the Voyageurs National Park. And that was not within either the Clean Water Council or the agency request. Additionally, Senator Stumpf has authored the request for the Red River Watch. And this has been in the bill. Each year we've had the legacy funding, but again, it's not something that was contained in the broader request. Senator Sieben and Senator Metzen authored the request for the inflow and infiltration reduction grants through the Metropolitan Council. I think those are the several pieces of the Clean Water Fund that are not contained within either the agency requests or the Clean Water Council. If members want to draw some of the contrast between the governor's recommendations, which represent obviously the agency requests I'm talking about, as opposed to the Clean Water Council, that's contained within the spreadsheet that was passed out. Article 3 is the Parks and Trails section, and this has been a section where there's been some, I guess it's fair to suggest, some controversy over the last several years. And you get into that, we've had this debate of how much money should we have for the state parks, how much money for the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks, how much money through the Metropolitan Council for the Metropolitan Regional Parks. Senator Ingebrigtsen last night raised some concerns that are not new to members relative to the division. When Senator Ingebrigtsen chaired the Legacy Committee, then it was Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe, a full committee. When Senator Ingebrigtsen chaired the committee, he established in his bill the governor's governor's commission to determine what apportionment should be made. And the recommendations from that committee, that commission, was a 40-40-20 split, 40% for state parks, 40% for the metro parks, 20% for the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks. I abided by that recommendation 2 years ago, and members might recall there was a lengthy debate on the floor, and in fact, I, as I'm always reminded by my friend Mr. Rice, voted against the Metropolitan position, feeling that I wanted to maintain the integrity of what was presented by the commission as presented by Senator Ingebrigtsen. And although there's some back and forth as to whether or not there should be a division, should the Metropolitan area have a little bit less or somebody else have a little bit more, my position in this bill is to maintain, as I did 2 years ago, what that recommendation was. There are some particular appropriations made in the bill. There's been a request from the Greater Minnesota folks relative to having some type of office structure, some kind of structure to the recommendations made for that section of the bill. And so that's contained within this proposal. Obviously, again, those monies come from within that 20%, and I believe that, as best I know, has met with the approval of senators from Greater Minnesota who are most involved with that appropriation. And I know there was some discussion when we had the subcommittee meet, but again, it seemed to be appropriate to present that. There are a couple of other appropriations. There are some trail requests which are contained not by appropriation but by placing them on the list. I think Senator Miller has the wagon wheel request. Senator Schmidt, I forget the name of it, but the Goodhue Pioneer Trail. Senator Tomasoni Has authored the Mesabi request, which I think is also found in 15 other bills in the state legislature, if I'm not mistaken. Am I higher or lower on that figure, Senator Thomas?
All right.
Anyway, we have the request for the Mesabi Trail authored by Senator Thomas. We also have a couple of other requests. Senator Herr, and this is done through the Metropolitan section of the parks, has authored a couple of small requests, a unique request, one that I think members of the subcommittee found not just simply entertaining, but fairly unique and fairly interesting, to establish a culturally relevant park, which would, I believe, be in the city of Maplewood. And additionally, there's a very small appropriation from, again, within that same section for the Chinese Friendship Garden, I believe in Phelan Park, that Senator Herr had requested. So those are some of the particular recommendations in Article 3. So allow me, members, to spend a couple of minutes on Article 4, because I've got somewhere here the A4 amendment, and I want to talk about Article 4. That's become very popular and a little bit beyond the scope of what I anticipated when I think I mentioned to members of the subcommittee last night, former Senator Jane Krentz, who was then chair of the Environment Finance Division, myself had a lunch, and we talked about potentially broadening what was that original sportsman proposal. And so I thought, I guess I didn't anticipate the credit collapse of 2008 and the fact that this would become a very popular section of the bill. So we have, so in the process, I just want to explain from where we are tonight as opposed to where we were last night. There were a couple things. First of all, as I looked at the proposed appropriation for what's in the spreadsheet titled the Board of Arts, but also includes the appropriation for the regional arts councils and the division agreed to by the Board of Arts and the regional arts councils, it kind of hit me that it seemed to be, I realize folks might be a little bit surprised at this, that there was actually too much money for the arts. And because what we did 2 years ago, in the discussion with the passage, the promulgation of the amendment and the passage of the amendment, in the same way that the discussion of the sportsman was to set up the council, try to maintain those recommendations, the discussion in the state during passage of the amendment and in the promulgation of the amendment through the legislative process was that 50% of this money would go to the arts, to the Board of the Arts and the regional arts councils. In the legislation that I've authored in 2009, 2000, and 2013, I presented that 50%. The agreement 2 years ago was to have the amount at 47%. And my intent was not to change that, to abide by that 47%, the same way I've abided by the 40-40-20 split. I'm not sure what happened yesterday with the spreadsheet we had, but it actually had something closer to 50%. And so that's a change that's been made. As a consequence, there were additional dollars. Second, we really didn't deal with the fund balance last night. So in some cases, there were appropriations made that were probably a little bit too low. And that's the bulk of the A4 amendment when I present that. But I want to make it very clear to members, make it very clear to folks who are here. I offered some distinctions relative to the House bill in terms of us taking into account our tax bill that passed 2 days ago that the House legacy bill could not take into account because the legacy bill in the House passed before the passage of the House tax bill. So that's a distinction that not so much for committee members here but for the folks who are present in the committee room should take note of.
Senator Cohen, did I hear you say that you had an A4 amendment?
Yep, Mr. Chairman, I do, but I want to make a couple of other comments relative to, if the chair will allow me.
Senator Cornyn, can I at least have the A4 amendment passed out so that we can
certainly
have that passed out? Okay, the
certainly
A4 amendment, if we can pass that out, please.
One of the things I want to make sure members understand is if you look at the spreadsheet on about four spreadsheets in front of me. Okay, if members would note line 220 of the spreadsheet.
Which line, Senator Cornyn?
Line 220. You'll 220? Note an appropriation for capital art preservation. That's $3.25 million. There was an agreement, discussion of what to do with the capital art restoration. And there's approximately $30 million needed to complete the work on the capital that has not been appropriated. Most of that, it is hoped, will be done in some type of bonding bill this year. There's been some discussion that some of this, that some of the art restoration might be bondable as well. The process would be cumbersome, it would be complicated, and the agreement was that we would appropriate the money in this bill. So for either members who are looking for significant increases for particular appropriations or folks in this room who are looking for that, there's your increase to some extent. That's $3.25 million taken out of the bill. It's obviously one time. It's obviously unusual. But in the discussions that I had earlier this year with Senator Box and Arrest myself, this seemed to be the place to do it. So I want to make note of that. I think in terms of other new appropriations in the bill, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. So if you take a look at the appropriations in Article 4, you will see in many instances either the appropriations the same from what we did 2 years ago. There are a couple of small changes, but that tends to be the change made. Or the lack of change made. And I think I don't want to draw a contrast, too much contrast with the House, but I think the House did some of that appropriation within one of the other appropriations. I've been able to do it outside, so we're not taking away money from one place or another, but it does hold some of those appropriations flat.
And Senator Cornyn, for the A4 amendment, are you going to go through that, or would you like Mr. Knopp or someone in particular to go through the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I was about to present the A4 amendment. Mm. Thanks for anticipating me. That's great. So let me move the A4 amendment, and it's been distributed. And I think I'll go through it. I'm going to ask staff to chime in if I'm making some mistakes. On line 1.3 is a technical change. The next is to present the Goodhue Pioneer State Trail in the same way we've done the other trails. Senator Tomasoni, relative to the Mesabi Trail, has asked for clarifying language. Senator Herr has asked for some just definitional changes relative to his park request. Senator Sieben has requested removal of the Washington County Trail. That's not necessary at this point. Line 1.17 is the new appropriation for total arts appropriation, so reflecting that approximately $2 million deletion, and that's then reflected in line 1.19 with the significant change of the $30.4 million to $28.247 million. The next several changes reflect the change in the line items of the arts board. One of the significant mistakes made last night, again, I explained to members as to some of what was happening with the fund balance plus the deletion of some of that money from the arts board, were some significant decreases from 2 years ago to the Historical Society. And I indicated last night to those folks that would try to work on that today, that's reflected in the next several areas. And as well as 1.33, line 1.33, where we had some of that capital arts restoration appropriation taken from the Historical Society. With this change in money, we can do that outside of taking money from, you know, one place or another, as I mentioned. So 1.34 represents the new total for the Department of Administration. A small change with NPR. 2 years ago, we had both NPR and AMPRS at the same amount. I'm not quite sure why I didn't do that in the bill last night, but that change is reflected in 1.36. The next page of the amendment, a slight increase to Como Zoo, which they had made a case for, was able, with some of the additional money, to make just some small increases in a couple of the appropriations, you know, $50,000 or so. However, another place where there was a mistake, and this was a misunderstanding, was the Humanities Commission. And this is why I mentioned at the outset, Mr. Chairman, that this, you don't have base amounts in this bill. It's a one-time appropriation. So what happened with the Humanities Commission is we had appropriated money 2 years ago, but in the Supplemental Finance Bill had appropriated additional money. And so that wasn't carried through as a base amount because there's not a base amount. And so did not want to deduct money from the Humanities Commission of a significant amount, and that's offered as well. Additionally, at the bottom, you have a request from the Historical Society to clarify monies for the Fulda Heritage Center as requested by Senator Weber and the Chickwack Heritage proposal as presented by Senator Bach. So that's a quick description of what's in the A4 amendment. I don't know if either Mr. Mumm or Mr. Knopf would like to add anything to that.
Any questions of the committee on the A4 amendment? Any questions? Senator Cornyn moves adoption of the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The A4 amendment is adopted. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to move the A5 amendment.
All right. The A5 amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, members, this is similar to the A4 with a project in Douglas County dealing with just the initial part of a regional park and a ski hill in that area. I talked to the chair earlier today, and I think it's unacceptable. It doesn't spend direct any specific dollars or anything, and so I'd urge your support.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum is
Senator
correct. He did talk to me. It's acceptable. And more importantly, Senator Westrum also spoke with Mr. Knopf, who's verified that it's acceptable. So between the two of them, it's great.
So I know that the A5 amendment is coming around. So Senator Cohen, just to be clear, so you see the A5 amendment as a friendly amendment?
Very friendly.
All right. And Senator Westrum has had an opportunity to explain it to us. I'll wait till Senator Anderson get the amendment. Any questions on the A5 amendment, members? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A5 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The A5 amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
A2 amendment, please.
And Chair, I'll ask Council as this is coming around how this fits in with the A4, which was just adopted. I know the A4.
All right. Oh. Mr. Bonner.
What's that?
Oh, Mr. Knopf. I'm sorry. Senator Dibble asked for you to explain the A2 amendment and how it connects with the A4 amendment that was just recently adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I think the A4 made some minor language adjustments to some of the same lines, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Gannett.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble and members, this was the issue came up in the subcommittee last night as to whether or not the specific money in here would be out of the allocations to each of the implementing agencies for the Metropolitan Parks. And this is to clarify it. Now, the if you look at the amendment, the A2 amendment lines 1.8 and 1.9 are not needed anymore. Senator Dibble, you could just as a incorporate into your amendment to not include 1.8 to 1.9 because as part of Senator Cohen's amendment, that portion was deleted. So you would just leave 1.1 through 1.7 in the amendment, and that would take care of the issues involved. And since the other one was deleted, you don't need to include 1.8 and 1.9 anymore.
All right, Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A2 amendment without lines 1.8 and 1.7.
All right. Any questions of Senator Dibble? Senator Cohen, you okay with this amendment?
I am. It's not quite as friendly as Senator Westrom's, but it's still pretty friendly.
All right. Any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The A2 amendment has been adopted. Any additional amendments?
Chairman.
Senator Ingram. Oh, Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, I have an A6 amendment.
A6 amendment? All right, A6 amendment, please.
You have one. You do yours if you want.
I didn't promote it.
Hand yours off. That's
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Tomasoni.
I spoke to Senator Cohen about this one, and I think this is a friendly amendment also. We heard this in front of the Legacy Subcommittee, and this is about the Hibbing High School Auditorium. It's a historic auditorium that needs refurbishing inside a building that is a historic building that is also on the historic register. And we've been trying to figure out how to fit this into this bill, and I think this works pretty good because it ends up in a competitive grant process and competes for the money. And also, the local school has already put in $13 million of their own money to refurbish it, so there's a considerable local match. So.
Senator Cohen, any thoughts about the A6 amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did speak to Senator Tomasoni, and I said it was acceptable. This I would consider a quasi-friendly amendment.
All right. Any questions of the committee on the A6 amendment?
Quasi.
All those in favor of adoption of the A6 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The A6 amendment is adopted. Any more amendments before? Okay. Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have some questions with regards to the capital restoration. And I know this has been discussion going on over the years. Can you just give me a guess, Senator Cohen, as to how many legacy dollars have been utilized or will be utilized for the capital restoration? And I don't say that in any other way than other than inquiring. I mean, I talk to folks all over the place in my district, and they think that's good. That's good that we use some legacy funding for the restoring of the historic value and arts and stuff inside here. So.
Senator Cohen.
Chairman Senator Britson, as best I know, this is the only appropriation is the one in this bill. I don't think we've appropriated other money in the legacy for the capital restoration. I think it's all been done in bonding other than this.
Thank you.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question with regards to the funding for the University of Minnesota on line 182, Senator Cohen. And I'm wondering if there's anybody here that could answer a couple of questions from the U that would be willing to give a little time here and a couple of questions.
Senator Engelbrechtson, can I ask a favor of you?
Certainly.
I definitely will allow that to happen, but I wanted to finish up all the amendments so that we have all the amendments, and then folks can ask any questions on the amendments or the entire bill, I should say. Are you okay if we finish taking the amendments and then we can have someone from the university come up?
Yes. It might precipitate an amendment to my discussion with the university, okay. Mr. Chair. If I could just – it won't take long.
All right.
So Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Ms. Vogel to
– All right. Senator Engelbrechtson, your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry.
Ms. Vogel.
Who am I talking to? The university, I guess. I'm sorry.
To the testifier of you, Vogel, Mary Vogel, correct?
Vogel. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Vogel. In 2010 and 11, Minnesota received $400,000 for Parks and Trails inventory and framework, and now in 2014 they received another $250,000 to update the inventory and framework. Can you tell me where we're at with that. Now we're requesting another $260,000 with this program to help to assist in us finding out where all the properties are statewide. And can you tell me where that is now?
And to the testifier, if you will state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
I'm Mary Vogel, co-chair of the Center for Changing Landscapes, University of Minnesota. When the initial appropriation was used for an inventory and framework, which was a really prodigious task because we had to contact everyone around the state to find out what where we were in terms of parks and trails. We knew that there were going to be some discrepancies because it was a prodigious task. We also analyzed users of parks and trails. And so part of what we've been doing is to not only bring up to date things have changed since the initial study, but also make some corrections. The request that we have for this amount of money is to continue and finish the work that we started over the last biennium. We have created, technology has changed since our initial work. There were some counties, we contacted every county in the state and got money or got information from them. So there was one county that didn't even have an answering machine. Now a lot of counties do, and there's a lot of technological capacity. So we have been working with Minute to create a tool that can be updated by people who manage parks and trails. We also were, the work originated by a request from the Senate, actually, because there was a concern about making investments in a context. They didn't know what the context was. And so we created a system which documented parks and trails from local to federal. And so that's one part of it. The other part of it is that we were quite frustrated with the quality of information about users. We did the best we could in terms of making some analysis of the user surveys that were available, but they weren't compatible. It was like comparing apples, oranges, and pomegranates. And so we have been working with the DNR, with the Metro Council, and with the Greater Minnesota Commission to create an instrument that that will be used by all three. And so the request for the money is to implement the survey that we have created in the last 2 years. This survey not only indicates what uses are seasonally, we would like to have another shot at creating information from winter users because we've had some unusual winters during the time that we were working. But we also recognize that the capacity to implement this survey is very important in order to get correct data. And the data is not only about who's doing what where, but also it does indicate what are some of the recreational needs. The database that I just referred to before talking about the user survey is a self-perpetuating one. It's an instrument that will be able to be updated by local counties and by other agencies. It will also include information. We've been working with MnDOT and we're going to be integrating the bicycle work that they are doing. So that what our work does is really provide a context for decision makers and for planning, and it also provides a context for users. They will be able to go online and see what's out there.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, any other follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just real quickly, I think you gave a very good description of what you set out to do, but we're talking about some years ago already, and there's no product yet. That's my concern. You did say that you were working, Ms. Vogel, with the Greater Minnesota Parks and DNR, which was another question I had, but you said that that you were. So I was just concerned as to when the product was going to actually come out to assist us, and that's the only question I had, Mr. Chair.
All right, when? Ms. Vogel?
Part of the product has been also determined by creating the database with Minut, so that we've got a pilot project now, and now we're in the process of taking the information and putting it in a form so that locals can update it. When it will be done, we anticipate it will be done within the next year.
Senator Cohen?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I had the chance to spend time not only with Ms. Vogel but the others involved, and as she's indicated, that the final product's not finished, but I had the chance to spend some time looking at everything that's been done up to this point, was impressed with what they've put together over these last this last year or so.
Any follow-up, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just was quite concerned that the Parks folks and the DNR were working with you with this, because this is an important piece that I think is going to be very valuable moving forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, members, I really would like to concentrate on the amendments. Any other amendments from the committee? I'm going to turn over the chairmanship to Senator Wieger, because I do have an amendment.
Okay. Senator Champion, you have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I have the A7 amendment.
Okay. The A7 is being distributed.
And as it's being distributed, this amendment is for a bus to honor the life and legacy of Nellie Stone Johnson. There's been a private group that's already been working on this, and there's a remaining a number of $30,000 that's needed. So I offer this amendment this evening to honor the labor and civil rights activist Nellie Stone Johnson, who was the first, just to give you a little information, because I know the amendment is still coming around, she was the first African-American woman elected to public office in Minneapolis, winning a seat on the library board in 1945. She was also a leader in organized labor in the 1930s and 40s and helped to found the DFL party and to desegregate the U.S. Army. She was a mentor to Vice President Hubert Humphrey and served on the Minnesota State University Board for 8 years while she worked to recruit and retain students of color. Ms. Johnson passed away in 2002 at the rightful age of 96. But has left an extraordinary legacy behind. In her memory, her life has been featured in the play Nellie, in the book Nellie Stone Johnson, The Life of an Activist. And there's also an elementary school named after her in my district called the Nellie Stone Johnson Community School. There was also a Nellie Stone Johnson scholarship program founded in 1989, which offers scholarships to minority students from Union families. And Ms. Johnson was known for her ability to build bridges between different groups as she often crossed partisan lines to create relationships for change. So yet a statue would be the ultimate thanks to a woman who has given so much to the state, and for this reason I'm asking you to support my amendment. And I did have an opportunity to talk to the chair about it, and the cost would be, or the appropriation that we're asking for, is $30,000.
Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion's correct that he and I have spoken about this, and I knew Nellie Stone Johnson, and Senator Champion's correct. She was a great Minnesotan. And would also point out that I think, Senator Champion, a good portion of this has been privately raised as well, about half of it or so. It's not all public dollars.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, comments from committee members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts?
I was fortunate also to know Nellie Stone Johnson. In fact, in that 1945 election when she was elected to the school board, my grandfather, Reuben Latz, was also a candidate who did not win in that election for the school board. But he had been a political mentor to Nellie Stone Johnson, who in turn was a political mentor to my father, Bob Latz. So we've got a multi-generational commitment to Nellie, respect for Nellie and her legacy. She would be a wonderful asset to recognize in the Capitol here as the first woman and the first African-American who would have a bust here in the Capitol. She's had a tremendous impact on the people of Minnesota, particularly in advancement of workers' rights and fighting discrimination of all kinds. So I'd be honored to support this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Further comments or questions? Senator Champion renews his motion, the A7 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you. Senator Cohen, to your bill. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Westrom. Sorry about that, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Cohen, you addressed the issue about the 40-40-20 split, and that's the division you've got in your bill. Senator Cohen, I guess I raised the issue about the fairness and the equity that somehow has played out to be fair with 80 counties getting 20%, 7 counties getting 40%, and then the DNR gets the other 40%. And I just raise the issue because it seems to me that those accounts should be more a third, a third, a third, or something more proportional. And I'm just wondering why we continue to stay at this 50% level of Metro Parks, and is there a way we could fix that in the future?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, as I indicated, when Senator Ingebrigtsen chaired the Legacy Committee in 2011-2012, he established a governor's commission to take a look at what would be equitable. There was significant input from all sections of the state, all parts of the state representing all the different parks. And the recommendations from that committee were 40-40-20. As I indicated, 2 years ago, there was an effort by the metropolitan area to change that percentage. I opposed that on the floor of the Senate. And I would oppose any change to that split at this point coming from the other direction. There were people who spent a great deal of time coming up with that percentage and viewed that as the equitable division. It takes into account the state parks. It takes into account the number of Greater Minnesota regional parks and takes into account the number and utilization of the metropolitan parks. And in the same way, I voted against the metropolitan position as articulated on the floor of the Senate 2 years ago. I would oppose a change this year going the other direction.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Westrom wanted to.
No.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Westrom?
I guess, Mr. Chair, just I raise a comment. I know the hour is late, but it does seem like this. You've got the LCCMR bill that just went through. There was millions in Metro Parks there, in addition to the 40% that's allocated here. And so I just think it is an issue that needs further discussion. Certainly 20% was the best we could get out of the negotiations at the time, but it still is half of 40, and there's a lot of parks in 80 counties and others that would like to be developed or enhanced. And so I just raised the issue for us to take strong consideration and look at.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I know there's some angst, obviously, over the division. And in fact, I think again, I've indicated what the history has been. I would certainly support having at some point a more complete hearing on the division and why one number versus another, but would not support some type of change in this committee tonight where we don't have the chance for a much fuller exposition that would take a significant amount of time. In the same way we talked a little while ago about the lack of public input or potential public input relative to Senator Sieben's proposed amendment, I would suggest this is an amendment that would take a significant number of people. So I understand the concern, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, Senator Ingebrigtsen expressed the same concern last night in the subcommittee. And I would certainly, either through the subcommittee or the full committee, have an informational hearing next year. And please remind me as we get into next year's session to have a fuller discussion of this. But we don't have that ability tonight to do that.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would concur with Senator Cohen. I would welcome a lengthier discussion because I think we'll learn things like the metro area has 54% of the state's population, generates 65% of all the sales tax for these legacy funds, only has 3 of 75 state parks. We have 50,000 people for each state and regional park compared with 12,000 per park in greater Minnesota. And the metro parks have 47 million user visits, nearly five times the visits to state and regional parks in rural Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So we can have this discussion about what's fair and equitable. And I think it would be some interesting facts to lay on the table.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for allowing me to at least answer to the Senator Cohen's laying out how this came over the past, and I agree. We did set money aside for Greater Minnesota Parks to organize. That was one of the biggest angst that everybody had. Obviously, we started out some years ago. We weren't in Greater Minnesota organized. We are now better organized, and we certainly have proposals now in Greater Minnesota that we didn't have in the beginning. Now, in the beginning, I might remind folks that Greater Minnesota actually received 14%, I believe, the first year, 2 years, and it was not exclusive. Actually, the metropolitan parks were able to actually come in and take funding from rural Minnesota at that time. So it's evolved, Senator Cohen. You're right. It has evolved. And we are now better prepared in Greater Minnesota, I think, than obviously we were when we started. So I would like to see this discussion myself. I'm glad that you're willing to be open to that. And when it comes to viewership, Senator Dibble, you made that point very clear. But I know there's one park in North Minneapolis that has some real questions as to the funding mechanisms there, as well as the viewership. I don't think it's quite as high as some expected it to be, and we're pouring dollars into that, and that's a different discussion for a different day. So I have some statistics that I'd like to share at that meeting, and I look forward to that.
And Senator Dibble, because I did say Senator Pappas, so I want to make sure I get to Senator Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen expressed some angst about the level of acquisition last night in terms of acquiring land. We have this report from 6 years of Legacy Parks and Trails success, and it shows that 9% of the resources to DNR, State Parks and Trails, was used for acquisition. 13% of resources for the Metro Parks and Trails used for acquisition, 25% for these Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble said mostly what I wanted to say, but I think the Metropolitan legislators would certainly be like to engage in this debate because we do feel like we have the visitorship that is attending the regional parks, and also we have we have standards for our parks, certain sizes that are required that I don't think the same standards apply to the Greater Minnesota parks. And, you know, I think we all are looking for equity
And we did feel in the past that the state parks were available for greater Minnesota, and we were mostly funding our own parks in the metro area ourselves, which isn't really fair. So having a discussion about this could be quite robust.
And I, with that,
look forward to it.
I will hope that we will have that discussion later, because I definitely want to talk about North Minneapolis and the park that you want to refer to, because I have a whole lot to say about that park and how many people of color, be it Asian and Latinos and others, who go to that particular park, and the money that goes there is minute in comparison to some of the other places where money is going. But that's for another day. Senator Cohen, Senator Limmer,
Mr. Chair, I just suggest that it's time to vote on the bill.
I'm with you. Senator Cohen, you have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that House Files 303 as amended be recommended passed.
All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Say aye. Well, I should ask any more discussion, but all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Senate File 303 passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Oh, we are adjourned?
We are.
Okay, thank you.
As amended.
Yeah, no, I saw them packing up, but I was
able as amended.
To vote. They have to be in the table. I'll let you know. Oh, he'll be like, do you guys
right behind you.